It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Alex, Andy, and Renee are all here to talk about the news from WhatsApp, to watch Taylor Swift take a faceplant. Did she really? And a whole lot more. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
It's time for Mac Break Weekly, episode 501, recorded Tuesday, April 5th, 2016, Purple Safari. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/MacBreak and use the code MacBreak30. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/MacBreak and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/MacBreak. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/MacBreak and using the promo code MacBreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest Macintosh and Apple news. Actually, really less and less Macintosh, more and more iOS. Andy Iannacco here from the Chicago Sun-Times. Always a pleasure. And many, many wonderful podcasts like Iannacco's Almanac. We were just talking before the show about it. Pod for Ham, which you do with Jason Snell and many in a cast of millions, which is the Hamilton soundtrack dissected one by song by song. You're almost at the end. You must be.
Must be. There's like there are so many of these recording simultaneously. Friday, I'm recording two episodes back to back, and I did another one before. So we're going to start running out of running out of tracks to go for. So
that's okay. You podcast like you're running out of time. I'm sorry.
I'm not gonna.
You're not throwing away your podcast.
I've almost like wanted to create one of those threat boards for like fire safety in the forest, where it's like, in terms of dropping like Hamilton song lyric jokes, we are now at the high level.
I know.
Where people are going to start audibly sighing, and then they start throwing things at you.
Another,
so like taper that down.
Also with us, great to have you once again from Montreal, Rene Ritchie of iMore.com.
Thank you, Leo. Back I home again. Importance in your honor.
Ah, do you miss it when you come down south of the 49th parallel? Do you miss the Hortons?
No, I go to Bitter and Sweet and Phil's and Blue Bottle, and mm-hmm. I drink in your marvelous coffee, and I'm super jealous and sad when I go home.
Which is your favorite? Because there's a battle in San Francisco between Phil's and Blue Bottle.
So they're so different. Phil's is the hippie pour over, and Blue Bottle is the hippie espresso based beverage. And I like both of them. So I'll go for a nice pour over at Phil's, and then in the afternoon go to Blue Bottle and get an espresso.
Nothing wrong with any kind of coffee at all.
Wondrous diversity, Leo.
Coffee's like sex. Even a bad cup is better than nothing.
I won't go that far, but I just like a wide range of coffee.
Also here from his beautiful studio, which is getting beautifuler and beautifuler, Alex Lindsay.
Hello.
Pixelcore.com. What is that over your left shoulder? It looks like an award.
Oh, it's a sculpture.
Hold on. It looks like a special. What do they call it?
This is the special.
A special award. Oh, that's neat.
It's cool.
Is that from Rwanda?
It's from Kenya. Actually.
Kenya.
So it's it's
beautiful.
Hard to fit in here. Yeah, it's great. It's kind of amazing. This stuff is you literally drive down the road and this is everywhere.
Nice.
And you know, buy it, and so it's cool. Yeah. And you know, we've moved, you know, the whole Blue Bottle thing is all, you know, blase. We're all past that, you know.
Oh yeah.
It's now Trouble Coffee.
Trouble.
You know, Trouble Coffee.
Don't even know Trouble. Next time you're here, will you bring me Trouble?
I'll bring you some Trouble. See, and that's the best part. You say, I'm gonna bring you some Trouble. There you go. And then when I tell one of our producers who lives near it, I'm finally out of trouble, and then that usually means I have to get back into trouble. So
who's the guy from Arrested Development? He has a new Netflix original show. It's all about these Santa Monica hipster losers. And then there's a coffee place that is called Free Coffee.
I was going to say Daredevil, but that doesn't
fit. Not Daredevil. It's called Free Coffee, and they always, and it's like a running joke. But is this on the house free, or is this free? No, it's free as a liberated man. $5. Free coffee. Hey, folks, let's talk about Apple. You know, the reason I made that snarky, snide comment about Macintosh at the beginning is I realized that here we are, new iOS devices, you know, iPhone SE, iPad Pro Junior. No word at all about new MacBooks, OS X, anything. It's as if it didn't exist.
Summer, Leo, summer.
I'm getting depressed.
Oh, just wait for the summer. You'll be happy.
I'm getting so depressed I've installed Linux on all my old Windows machines. That's how depressed I am. I'm worried. I shouldn't worry.
I mean, like, when you look at how Skylake has worked so far and you look at things like the Surface Book, I'm happy for them to wait.
They dodged a bullet on that. Yeah.
I think so. Like, I think, like, they're a smart company. Originally, like, when you look at the Mac Pros, Intel didn't really create the chips that Apple would use for some of those devices. They did do a Skylake, I think, in the 27-inch iMac, but it's not clear that all the right chips were available at all the right times. And I'm not sure exactly how much difference it'll make in looking at the Surface Book and the problems. I mean, Paul Theroux was really good at documenting those problems.
Yeah, as was I. Both of us purchased Surface Books.
I'm just as soon happy to get a really, really good MacBook at WWDC than a really fast one at the beginning of the year.
I've been reassured again by Microsoft, which thought they had patched this in February, these Skylake power issues in February, that no, we know there's still problems, and we think we have it this time. So maybe Apple did the right thing.
It's a hard, like, when you look at it, it's taken Intel so long to move to 14 nanometer, never mind 10 nanometer. And now Samsung and Taiwan Semiconductor are basically fabbing at the same size now as them. The world has changed. The whole way that chips are made and produced has changed, and it hasn't been an easy transition.
I do have to say that one of the things that using Linux on a Windows machine, besides giving me the great pleasure of eliminating Windows, is I feel like what leaps to mind is the right tool for the right job. And I'm sure, Andy, you agree on this because you're not all Mac, all Apple. And I have the S7. I love it. The new iPad Pro 9.7-inch has really proven to be exactly what I kind of wanted, which is the ultimate kind of super portable, like, blogging tool. This keyboard is fine, and it's so light and small, I keep it in my backpack. It's great. But it's definitely different than the command line Linux. But that's what I like on the laptop. So it's kind of like the right tool for the right job.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking about pairing. I've now, of course, I take the iPad Pro with me wherever I go, whenever I leave. And now I'm sort of thinking that perhaps the ultimate street bag is now going to be the iPad Pro and the iPad Mini that I bought early last year. I'm thinking about...
You're going to carry two iPads?
Because I'm thinking about, like, all this. The only thing I don't like about the iPad Pro is that if I'm, like, on a bus that's going to take me 40 minutes, or I'm on a train that's going to be, like, an hour out, like, on the subway, I'll take out the Pro on the commuter rail. I will not take it out on the subway because you're holding a lunch tray. And so I just sort of got enamored with the idea of, like, starting an audio editing project. Jason Snell was on iOS Today yesterday, and it really got me. I should really try to see if I can edit audio on this thing. The idea of picking up a project where I left off, like, on this tiny little portable device, and then when I get back to a place where I'm at a desk and a keyboard, actually use that sort of thing. As you say, though, it really is the right device for the right job. I could easily decide that I'm going to be using this as my canonical I'm on the subway sort of device. I was even tempted to get a Surface Pro 4 because of the things that it can do that would fill the need of a good 13-inch super slim tablet. And fortunately, we now live in a world in which you could really split your world between macOS, iOS, Windows, and Android, because everything that's a serious player is now so multi-platform and so heavily conceived as a mobile cloud-based thing that it basically almost makes – you can basically choose just the thing that you want and know that it'll somehow work together.
And if it's VR you want, you're going to be using Windows 10. Yeah. And we've been playing with the Oculus Rift, and people can't keep their hands off of it. It's Yeah. It's been so much fun, and I can't wait to, or their heads, yeah. I can't wait to get the Vive, which should come pretty soon.
The first time you use a real good headset that has zero latency and high frame rate every single moment, the stuff that Samsung is doing, it's really quite nice. The stuff that Google's doing with Cardboard, also really quite nice. But the first time you're strapped into Rift or HTC's new headset, and you're like, oh, I'm now actually here. There's a pinball game that's available for this release day and date with the new Oculus. Somebody created a pinball controller that they essentially just built the first foot of a pinball cabinet. So it's on the same metal legs, the same height, and it's got flipper buttons on the side. And so which seems silly until Norm at tested.com had a video about it where you get to lean over the table just as you would to see, like, from left to right where the ball is going. And that's the difference between, hey, I'm playing a neat computer game, to, no, I'm having a pinball experience. I've had so many different experiences with VR gear that just gets me so excited. It's the ultimate demo. It really is the ultimate demo.
Well, and one of the things I wonder about is whether some of the comments made about dropping the Mac platform for Oculus and so on and so forth accelerate.
What was it that Palmer Luckey said? We'll make Oculus as soon as Apple makes I think he used the word garbage.
And I know that kind of stuff comes off, you know, but people should, I mean, I've been on the other side of what happens when people do that with Apple, and it's maybe a little different than when Jobs was there, because that would have lit Jobs up, you know. Because when I was at Lucasfilm, when the Avid marketing guy said they were going to drop the Mac platform, and it was pretty exciting. We got a lot of machinery really fast. You know, like Apple, you know, immediately flipped into a different gear than it was the week before about Final Cut. Final Cut was like this little test for them, and then it just became, you know, an Avid killer. You know, and so it's interesting as Apple starts to dip its toe into this process as to whether, you know, a tax on it or a dropping of the platform may accelerate, you know, some of their plans, you know, down the road if they're going to get into that market. I mean, they haven't announced anything, of course.
It's definitely a platform on the move. Hard to say if it's going to be the next big thing in capital letters, but it is definitely one of some strong contenders for the next platform. Including, by the way, messaging. And that's another thing. Apple has a toe in the water, but hasn't really... They don't do anything cross-platform yet. And I think that keeps... That's going to make a...
It's the old BlackBerry game where you keep BBM proprietary because you think it helps you, and then one day it's detrimental and WhatsApp gets sold for $17 billion.
Speaking of WhatsApp, big announcement from WhatsApp just broke this morning. They are switching on encryption for everything: messaging, audio, video, phone calls, end-to-end encryption. And it's going to be good encryption because it's being implemented by a hacker whose name is not only memorable but well-known to people who listen to Security Now, Moxie Marlinspike. They have added end-to-end encryption on WhatsApp now to every form of communication on their service. And I can only imagine how law enforcement is going to react to this. Remember, they're already being, sued by the Department of Justice over messages that they say, we can't tell you what's in the message. We have no way to access it. So this is really...
And again, I think this was a PR mistake by the FBI. By turning this switch on, I think they definitely accelerated all these companies looking at trying to build basically things that are already going to be out there that are not... You know, you can't go back. I mean, I think that it has created an arms race that they didn't need to create, that maybe we would have gotten to anyway. But I think that they definitely accelerated the whole process by pushing something that they ended up dropping in the end.
It already had encryption. It was since 2013. In fact, that's it's not an active lawsuit, but the government has asked for a wiretap. They're considering a court case after a wiretap order ran into WhatsApp's end-to-end encryption, according to the New York Times. The Joseph DeMarco is a former federal prosecutor, said the government doesn't want to stop encryption, but the question is, what do you do when a company creates an encryption system that makes it impossible for court-authorized search warrants to be executed? What is the reasonable level of assistance you should ask for from that company? And this is a Facebook-owned company, so they have plenty of resources to defend themselves. They are a United States company, widely used, though, in fact, more widely used outside the U.S. than inside the U.S.
That's interesting, because what do they do when other countries ask for that? I mean, was it WhatsApp that had to turn off service because of a legal dispute in one country?
Yeah, but Brazil, Brazil said, if you don't hand this over, we're going to shut you down. What they didn't take into consideration is that 93% of all Brazilians use WhatsApp. SMS messaging is prohibitively expensive in that country. So after 24 hours, the government backed down and said, sorry, never mind. And, of course, Telegram, one of the other competitors to WhatsApp, had a boon of over 1 million signups in that 24 hours in Brazil. Moxie does Open Whisper systems, and I think it's off the record, OTR encryption that they implement, which is very strong. Steve will talk about this, no doubt, next show. but bringing in Moxie Marlin Spike reassures everybody in the crypto community that unlike Telegram, which rolls its own encryption, this will be real, true, strong encryption that the government, not only the government can't get into, but it presumably it will be implemented properly so that WhatsApp can't get into it. And that's going to be the key. Now what will have to happen if this goes forward is this will be the showdown where the government has to say, we demand, and I think they would do it. We demand of WhatsApp as a U.S. company to provide us with the back door. And that will be an interesting case. And you're right. I think maybe a misstep on the Department of Justice's part because of the high profile of the Apple case.
I think it almost forced everyone to go down that path. Like, you know, you had to now be, you know, if you're going to do it, the key is you want to, it's kind of like when you have records, the key is you can't destroy them after the government asks for them. You know, you can only destroy them legally before the government asks for them. So a lot of these companies, before the government starts to legislate rules of encryption, I think a lot of these companies are trying to get things into place, you know, and make it more and more difficult to manage that process.
You know, 1 billion people use WhatsApp.
Yep.
This is the case. We try
in Brazil, Leo, and we have to put it back because if we choke to him, everybody use it.
Now, we should point out that Rene is an expert in Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
I've been yelled at by a lot of really famous Brazilian people.
So he has respect for the Brazilians.
Muito bom. Muito cansado.
And I'm actually thrilled, and I will now start using WhatsApp, right? Because this is exactly how it should be. There have been other, of course, many others, including Whisper's own Open Signal before this. But WhatsApp is everybody. You got to use a messaging system that everybody uses. It does no good to use Threema, a secure messaging system, if no one else is using it.
And the more the better, because if it's one company, you can bring all the resources of the government against it. But if everybody is doing this, it's much harder to, you know, people will just move around between services.
Yeah, Google, you want to stand with Apple?
Yeah.
Facebook, you want to stand with Apple? This is how you do it. Just encrypt.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the direction they're going.
It's strong public key crypto. Actually, the founders, Acton and Coombe of WhatsApp, have deep roots in the security and crypto community as it is. And bringing in Moxie Marlin Spike just makes it even more credible.
And we have so much. I mean, right now it's messaging, but everything is going to be tied to these services. They're so popular as payments. Some of them, especially in the Far East, they're used as gaming platforms. They're used as commercial platforms. Yeah. They are the platform on top of the smartphone. And it's having those be vulnerable is just not acceptable to anybody. It'll limit the growth of them.
Yeah. Well, as Wired points out, WhatsApp is probably one of the largest, if not the largest, communications network in the world.
Yep.
So this is a big one. This is bigger than AT&T say they're doing it. This is bigger than this is big. 1 billion active users. Let's take a break. We're going to move on. Lots to talk about. I want to get your reactions to the new hardware. All of you have. I don't know if all of you do. Some of you. One of you.
As tiny little.
As a tiny little phone.
So small.
Jason Snell brought it by yesterday, and it's like, well, that's the iPhone 5. I know. I mean, it's exactly the same.
Welcome back. Your dreams.
We'll find out while MarketWatch says Apple's about to get a lot more of your money. I don't think they could have more of my money. They have so much already.
All of it.
and a lot more. And, of course, it's the 40th birthday of Apple. And we celebrated on Triangulation yesterday with a marathon, three-hour interview with Bill Atkinson, one of the original Mac team members, a creator of QuickDraw, the fundamental drawing routines that made the Mac possible, Mac Paint, the first painting program, HyperCard. He founded General Magic with Andy Hertzfeld and was incredibly generous. In fact, so much so, I said, well, I'll go as long as you can go. He said, well, how long? Let's go all day. So we did 3 hours, and we'll splitting it into two different triangulations. The first one went up, of course, yesterday. We'll talk a little bit about that. But first, a word from IT Pro TV. A lot of you are in IT or want to get into IT. If you love technology, why wouldn't you want to do it for a living? But there is this roadblock, this barrier to getting a job in IT called the CERT. The certifications, and there are lots of certifications out there. You know, you don't have to have a cert to know stuff, right? Obviously not. I don't have a cert. None of these guys have certs. But it is imperative in many cases to get that job. And I have to say, IT Pro TV is a great way to prepare for the certification tests and to get real useful knowledge, not just study for the test, but to actually learn stuff you need to know. Go to itpro.tv/MacBreak right now. They have over 1,000 hours of content, and they're doing 50 hours a week now, two studios running full-time 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. You can stream them live. You don't even have to pay for an account to watch live. But if you pay for an account, then you can watch on demand on your Chromecast, your Roku, your Fire TV, your Apple TV. Yeah, they just added an Apple TV app that's really nice. Your PC. You pay for a year at a time. You can even download them and take them on the go without an internet access, without an internet connection. Everything from Mac integration basics, Mac management basics, Apple certified support professional, Apple certified technical coordinator, of course, Cisco and ISC Squared, the certified ethical hacker cert. You could study for it all. Microsoft certs. And there's lots more. If you're, for instance, learning how to use a Windows server and you don't have a Windows server, who does? Many of us can't afford to do that. They have these virtual machine labs. All you need is an HTML5 compatible browser. And you can set up a Windows server, set up multiple clients, do it all. And that's part of the subscription. They also have the Transcender practice exam, so you can take the exam before you take the exam. That's worth $109. That's part of your low monthly subscription price. And by the way, they're geeks. They know. They're not going to hide the cancellation box. They make it easy to cancel when you get the cert. You're not going to want to. They know that because it's like having IT buddies always available to answer any question. They have full transcripts. They have Q&A sessions, which are like study groups. Corporate and group pricing is available. They told me the other day when they were here that the entire Harvard IT department now has an IT Pro TV subscription. Check it out, itpro.tv/MacBreak. Upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certs. Normally, $57 a month, but our special deal when you use the offer code MacBreak30 will give you a free week with a run of the place. You get the courses, the live stream. You'll also get 30% off for the lifetime of your account. That brings it down to $40 a month. Or really save, subscribe for a year, $399. But you've got to use the offer code MacBreak30. It's itpro.tv/MacBreak. Try it free for 7 days. Get those certs. Get that job. Keep that job with IT Pro TV. You're watching MacBreak Weekly.
WhatsApp just put out their white paper on the security, Leo. I stuck it in the show notes.
Let me take a look at it. I presume it's OT. Look, you know what? It's Koeman, Acton, and Marlin Spike.
Yes. Smart people.
That's all you need. I'm satisfied. I mean, the real question, of course, and I'm sure Steve will go over this himself, is not that it's strong encryption. We know that. But are the keys totally yours? Are the keys stored in any way at WhatsApp? And it doesn't look like they are.
Yeah, it's super detailed. It's really nice.
So, man.
Transport, security, everything.
And it, yeah, and it's on all messaging. Yeah, they're using OTR. It looks like it's on all messaging. Well, that's great. Oh man, wow, that is a shot across the bow.
More like this, please.
Yeah, yeah. You nailed it. If everybody did this, then what are you going to do? It's like done.
Well, the problem is then it becomes a conversation about competitiveness of U.S. companies, because if you have international companies and U.S. companies and everyone adding it all, it becomes this Pandora's box that's very hard to put all back together from an encryption perspective.
Yeah. You know, Steve was going to do a crypto solution. Steve Gibson, the host of Work Security Now, and he saw that this was a couple of years ago. He saw this coming. He decided, I'm not going to make it because I don't want to be like LavaBit.
Yeah,
and have to go out of business because I refuse to help the government, and that's what LavaBit did.
Pulling like Reddit and pulling your canary out of your.
Oh, there's another one, right?
Yeah.
Last week, Reddit had
ask me anything.
No, they had a canary. What do they call them? NSL canary.
Yeah.
So other companies, Apple does. Is Apple's canary still there?
I don't think so. I have to double check, but I think they lost it.
Apple
years
did
ago.
It. So the idea is you're not allowed when you get a national security letter in most cases to say you got a national security letter. These are the letters that are issued by the secret FISA court saying hand over the goods on user X. And by the way, you may not tell user X or anybody else that we just asked you for this under penalty of going to jail for the rest of your life. So you can't do this reactively. You can only do it proactively. So what Reddit did and what Apple did is they put in their transparency reports, to date, we have not received an NSL request from any federal agency.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
But it disappeared from Reddit's transparency report last week, which means they did.
Yeah.
And Apple did this first that I was aware of.
Yeah, I think they lost theirs a couple of years ago. Yeah. I have to double check. Yeah.
And the cool thing is that, of course, Reddit can't talk about anything like that themselves. So a couple of people did an AMA.
Oh, really?
about this
what
thing.
That means.
Not someone inside Reddit, but two intellectual property safety and security experts basically said, here's everything that that can be told about their interaction with this. So it's. Oof. It's going to blow up to a point where this really has to be an open discussion, and it's going to end with deciding, is this going to be a principle or is this just going to be something we're going to deal with? Meaning that do users have the ability to encrypt things and have a secret that the government cannot get at, or is that not something that people have the right to have? And either way, you're going to have to accept some bad stuff that goes with whatever way the issue went for you.
Yeah.
Apple lost theirs in September 2014.
Oh, it was that long ago?
It was a while ago. Well, I really think there's going to be a lot more, a lot less secrecy behind NSLs from now on. It really, the number of national security letters that have been issued over the past, since 2006, numbers in the high thousands, I think something like 12,000, 13,000. It's not something that is a very special, we must go to the special oak paneled room in our robes and make this plea to someone. And it's like, no, it's a real it's turning to a real bureaucratical procedural thing where if you want it, you get it. Basically, it might have been hard to get initially, but now the process is so well trodden that if you know how to get the NSL, if you actually definitely want to get it. And so it's once people realize exactly how much power a national security letter has and how little oversight there is and how little visibility there is, I really think that's one of these tipping points that's going to be part of that long. It's almost like we're going to have like a Vatican II sort of council. Of discussion of because they're two different forces that are very, very important that seem to have absolutely completely incompatible goals with each other. And it's just going to have to be a long conversation that maybe even amends the Constitution to really define this in such a way that it informs every law that comes after it.
And I think that one of the real challenges here is also that I think that to do this, you have to do it internationally. They're going to have to get all the countries to have some kind of charter that says that they're not going to do this. And it's going to be so hard to corral that in. We're talking 5 to 8 years. And at the same time, you're going to have software companies and hardware companies trying to do everything they can to get to a point where they've sold 200 million phones by then, or 300 million phones that are already so far down the path that it would be very difficult to, you can't roll them back. I think that's the key, is trying to get it under the bridge before you can do anything about it.
A lot of quantum computing research being done right now.
Yeah. 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 Really, that's what's going to have to happen, right? They're just going to have to get faster computers.
And they're working on ways of protecting against quantum breaking, too. So cat and mouse continues.
I've been hearing a lot of people talking about how the next step for encryption or for data security is going to be stuff like artificial intelligence, where you can actually go ahead and say that we the makers of the security product literally do not know how this product works because we're using machine intelligence to create it. This the same way that at Google, the developers of the Go app that made headlines a few weeks ago by being the first really competitive and successful Go app, the developers will tell you, we do not know what this app strategy is. We did not come up with it because this app is creating its own playing strategy whatsoever. It's amazing that a lot of this, the roadmap for these products is going to be more and more important that we, the makers of this product, do not even have the ability to access this data. Otherwise, we are, it's not just a principle thing. It's, we do not want to spend 40% of our time every single week dealing with responding to the demands of law enforcement. The only way to prevent that is to say, we literally do not know how to get at this data.
Incidentally, that appears to be what WhatsApp has done. I've been reading through the white paper, and they're doing something that Threema does as well, which is a QR code that allows you to in-person verify. So the next time you guys are out here, we should exchange QR codes. And here's what they say. WhatsApp users additionally have the option to verify the keys of other users with whom they are communicating. So they're able to confirm that an unauthorized third party, including WhatsApp, has not initiated a man-in-the-middle attack. This can be done by scanning a QR code or by comparing a 60-digit number. This is a way to fully verify that you and only you and your correspondee have the keys. And that eliminates WhatsApp's ability to do anything, which is what they want, which anybody should want, I guess. But what do you think, though, of the very real and legitimate desire for law enforcement to protect us against criminals?
It will get worse until we can't ignore the fact is that law enforcement above and all wants to do things that are in the end good for us, even if sometimes the way that they do that is bad for us. That we're going to, it's there is no one right answer to all of this. We're I do believe that in principle, the right of the individual to have a secret from the government is really important. It's how you wind up with a government that you feel as though you're proud to be part of, or part to be a subject of. However, we are going to have to be okay with a time 3-5 years from now, maybe even 3 or 5 days from now, where we're gonna have, there's going to be no bones about it. Here are where all of these people's, all the people who killed those 500 people, the plans were right. They put it on a public server. The FBI, law enforcement, international law enforcement had a copy of all their plans, but they could not get at it. And now after the disaster happened and they got the guys that are responsible and they decrypted the stuff, they saw that, nope, this was, if we had the file itself, if we could get inside it, we could definitely stop this thing from happening. And then we're going to have to say, it's a horrible thing that it happened. We are so sorry for the loss of lives. We still believe that the principle is an important principle. Yeah. And I would like to think that when that time comes, I will be clear voiced and say, we weren't just hippies waving flags about, hey, you know, the government, get your hands off of our data. You have to understand that this is going to cost human lives at some point. You have to be okay with that. It's not wrong to be okay with that, but you have to understand this is one of those principles that will have far reaching implications. Just like the principle of citizens do not have a right to have a secret will also have far reaching implications. And you have to be okay with that, too, if you support that side.
Can we deal with that now with Miranda? I mean, like, it would be much easier if police didn't have to use Miranda or if you weren't presumed innocent. I mean, there are countries where you aren't presumed innocent.
That's right.
And forums where you aren't. Yep. And all these things are greatly inconvenient and guilty people do go free. But we decided as a society that there were certain rights that were so important that I forget what the cliche is, but better, you know, for 100 guilty people to go free than one innocent man to go to jail or one innocent person to go to jail. Yep. And this might be one of those things.
It's like the Fifth Amendment is the Fifth Amendment has always been that sort of thing that makes me recite the fact that the law is hysterically funny. But the law, but the Fifth Amendment is all there to say we do not have the right to force things out of your head. If there's something that you know, we don't have the right to demand that you say it. One of the ways to demand you to say something you don't want to have to say, that it basically puts yourself in a vulnerability, is to say things that are going to incriminate yourself. And one of the reasons why this all this sort of stuff gets so interesting is because the law basically says that if you have the passcode, but the thing that you want to keep secret is actually a file, the government cannot force you necessarily to tell them what the password is, but they can force you to give them the contents of that document because that document is not inside your head. It's a file that you decided to create and take out of your head. So that's why in some jurisdictions, it's turned into we can force you to, by this court order, to go inside a private locked room, tap in your passcode in such a way that none of us can see it, will ever know it, but then unlock your phone and hand the phone to us so that we can see it. Because, again, the document is not controlled by the Fifth Amendment, but something that is secret inside your head is. It's the reason why they can take a dead man's fingerprint and use that to unlock someone's phone, or basically coerce and compel you to put your fingerprint on a fingerprint reader, because, again, that's not private information. That's not something you created and just sort of thought of. But, again, if there's something that you decide to memorize and just decide to memorize this 81,000 word piece of information, they can't get it out of you, because there is an amendment to the Constitution that said that something that's inside your head is, you have the right to have it inside your head. And there are ways to compel you to tell that secret despite your rights. I've been reading a lot of stuff now that basically says that really they can just decide to hold you in contempt of court until you agree to do something that they want you to do. So
yeah, journalists still in jail today for not revealing their sources.
Wouldn't it be amazing if your phone became something like a priest or a lawyer or a doctor where there's privilege and it was excluded? Because we decided.
Well, that's exactly what Obama said. He did. You know, he said, let's not fetishize these phones. I think that's exactly what he's saying.
Well, the question is if your phone is capable of giving you psychological advice, does that make it your psychologist or legal advice? Does that make it your lawyer? You know, when you get to an AI or a life position there, it could change the nature of what that phone
that's
represents.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah. Again, these are such deep, deep issues. One of the problems, I've been doing a lot of research into AI now, but a lot of law enforcement are kind of concerned about some of the tools they're using, because AI-based tools are exceptionally good at taking a terabyte of information and turning it into one or three names that are going to be very interesting for their purposes. But nonetheless, at some point, they might not at the local jurisdiction level, but at like the federal appeals level or the Supreme Court level, they're going to have to prove that here is how we got this information. And if they're using an AI where they don't know how this works because it's a machine learning thing, that might make it difficult for them to defend this piece of evidence or to defend this technique. And it's all because of, again, basic principles. We are a society that has decided that found guilty, you have a right to appeal. You have a right to know who your accuser was. You have the right. Exactly. You have the right to know how this material, evidence was brought against you. And this can be a big pain in the butt. It's the reason why a lot of absolutely, completely guilty people go free, because we know who did it. We know how he did it. This person was all but bragging about it. We have video of someone doing something that's not exactly the same thing, but we've got him. There's no question about it, but we can't convict him because we have to go by the rules in order to do it. Like I said, it's incredibly inconvenient. It's not necessarily even objectively the only way we can have a justice system, but this is the system that we decided that this is going to be an expression of the sort of society that we want to create, and that's why we picked this with its problems intact.
Well, and our Constitution was written by people who were pissed off about the government and said, focused the first 10 things on these are the things we don't want the government to do to us. You know, that was, you know, so the, you know, our, you know, because other countries don't have, you know, a lot of these rules. And you know, there are a lot of things, you know, our pictures and everything else are not the only thing that they get from our phones. So, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, that I was talking to somebody about, you know, we had something stolen in another country and it was returned to us very quickly. And I was kind of curious on how you do that. And they said, well, you just have to look at what phone doesn't belong here. Oh, you know, like I know where all these phones are. What phone doesn't belong here? And then I just follow that phone back. And then I say,
one of these phones is not like the others.
Well, you identify what phone doesn't belong there. And then he goes, And then you identify all the phones that that phone hung out with. Oh, and then boy. You identify all the phones yep. that they hang out with. And he said what's important, and this is why the whole thing is important. This wasn't in our country. It was another country. That's why being able to log all that data with
phones. That's why metadata is so valuable. Yeah,
that because they don't care about your actual – I mean, they care about your conversations, but that's too much data. What they really want is just to know who was talking to who and what was there, because then you find out that this person does something in San Bernardino – and now you can back up to right. every phone, every person they talked to on their phone or texted or where all the places that they were for the last. And that data is actually, and that is why the NSA was so much more apoplectic about that than breaking into someone's phone, because a lot of these people are using burners and they're using all kinds of other things. But even with that burner phone, I can still tell where you were, you know, for the last 2 days, you know. And so that is, you know, there's a lot of data that they're already pulling from our phone. And I think that where it got to be, even for me, you know, beyond that edge, was compelling a company not breaking into the phone. I think the FBI has the right to try to break into a phone. It was the compelling a company to write new code. Like, I think that is a point where we have to say, okay, whoa. You know, that's
the point at which the government says, we don't care how what you have to do to get this data. That's your problem, not ours. It also creates a problem where. How can Apple prove that they are complying with this court order if they can't actually do this? Again, they're creating systems in which it is not possible for them to ideally not possible for them in any way, shape, or form to work around this. If there is a way they can get around the passcode, that means that there is a way that they kind of screwed up. On some level. So what happens when someone says, "Look, I don't care that the suspect." Threw this document into a cross-cut shredder and then doused it in hot water, boiled it into a pulp, and then basically spent 10 miles on I-95 throwing clumps of this pulp out. It is your we've collected, we think, all of the pulp. It is your responsibility now to figure out how to reconstruct that document. What happens when a company can say, no, we don't know how to do that. It is not possible for us to do that. Vatican II, man. We're going to need a. It's going to be as fundamental as saying, is it okay to do masses in English instead of Latin
right.
anymore?
Right.
It's going to take a while.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I for one have downloaded and installed WhatsApp. I encourage you all to do so. To thank them for doing the right thing.
And the main reason that I don't use, I mean, I have WhatsApp on my phone, and the main reason that I don't use it very often, the irony of the whole thing is because WhatsApp is attached to a specific phone number, and, right. and I have multiple devices.
Yeah, me too.
And so the funny thing is
I attach it to my Google Voice number, though. That way I can have it on a bunch of devices.
Because I was just like, you know, that what kills me is that I can't, you know, I put that in that, you know, because I'm in other countries, and I use different phones in different countries, and suddenly it's not available.
You probably can't use Google Voice either then, right?
Yeah, so I use in Rwanda. I have a Rwanda right. phone, you know, and everyone in Rwanda uses WhatsApp. So you can't talk to them any other way. Right. If you're gonna text, you know, and so like everybody, like there's, I mean, you know, you just can't talk to anyone.
Do you think Facebook? I mean, it is owned by Facebook. Then we'll use this as an opportunity not to encrypt Messenger, and say, well, look, you know, we give you the choice.
I don't think so.
You think they'll encrypt Messenger?
Yeah, I think they'll figure it out with WhatsApp and then flip it.
I would love it if they encrypted Facebook and Messenger and everything. Keep every, you know, I guess you can't, they're not going to be able to do that with the Facebook site. Too late there.
Smart.
Yeah.
Just Messenger would be a big step forward.
Believe it or not, a Credit Suisse analyst says the stock market is undervaluing Apple.
No.
isn't it pretty highly valued right now? Maybe not. according to Kolbinder Garcha, he says investors might be underestimating and underappreciating the growth potential of services like Apple Pay, Apple Care, that's the new one they announced, Apple Music, and iCloud. He estimates gross profit related to services has grown to about $14.5 billion. It was $3.5 billion in 2010. And says that should double to nearly $34 billion by 2020. The amount each of us spends on services, he expects to skyrocket by 85% to $113 a year. It's currently $61 a year. So, yeah, okay, maybe I pay Comcast more, but that's about it. And if Apple were to, for instance, launch a TV service, he says, well, even more, this would increase Apple's share of this would increase the share of services percentage of Apple's profit from which is currently 15% to 30%.
Is it possible to like still not care about anything that a financial analyst says, but also think that they happen to have some good points?
Yeah. No, you always, and you're really good about this, point out that the financial analysts have a different audience. They're not journalists. They're talking to investors. They're trying to figure out if it's worth buying the Apple stock.
But, or they're told their clients a couple days ago to do something, and now right. they want to see what they can do to move right. it for them.
But Garcha, I think, is not far off, right?
Well, Apple was very careful at the last conference call. Tim Cook especially was very careful to position Apple, and Luca Maestri as well, as a services company.
Right.
Because the previous narrative about Apple just being an iPhone company was running thin as there were less and less markets for them to conquer, and they had to start getting into this more segmented approach. So the services narrative is huge for them. And I think Apple is undervalued. You know, look at the price-to-earnings ratio of a lot of other tech companies, some of them who have very little profit or very little historical
like
success.
Amazon.
Totally, like Amazon. I mean, if Apple had a similar price-earnings ratio as Amazon, $3 trillion company.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is definite room just for investor confidence, if nothing else, to grow.
And I think the number that was interesting in that article was I think it's 585 million active users, and
almost a billion users, yeah. and more than half of them active.
Right, and a very large number of them being considered affluent. You know, and so the thing is that when you're trying to value a company, that is, you know, it's not just everyone's using it. It's people that spend money, and so I think that that's something that he outlined in the article. And I think that that is part of what makes that value. You know, as they roll out new services, they already have a built-in clientele that is already interested in it.
That's very good news for the company, because at 40 years old, it's long in the tooth for a tech company. But everybody, Microsoft, Amazon, you know, Microsoft is no longer an operating systems company. It's a software as a service company. Amazon's no longer selling, a merch at a store. It's a software as a services company. Google is no longer an advertising company. It's a software as a services company. Though everybody's making this move, or trying to at least position themselves to make this move, because that's the future, isn't it?
Well, and Apple has this historical problem with the coin flipper, fallacy, where everyone looks at Apple and they say, well, they're doing well this year, but that just means they're going to tank next year. Oh, they didn't tank this year. They're going to tank twice as bad the year after. Oh, it's like watching a good gambler at Vegas when he's just winning hand after hand and saying, oh, the next one absolutely is going to bust, when the odds of each one is the same. There's no real difference. And every year Apple does something and they say, well, the next iPhone, that's going to be the last one. But you can't judge things based on that. Yet Wall Street is filled with human beings who really do want to judge things that way. So it behooves Apple to really change this narrative, something that's much more easily understandable by them.
But we have said many times that Apple sucks at services. So what's the answer here? Is it true? Does Apple have to get better at services? Are they good enough?
It depends on definition. Like, they've sucked at cloud infrastructure, but like Apple Store provides phenomenal services, and there's ways to parlay a lot of that. And whether or not they so far, Apple Pay has been a tremendously good service, which is not reliant, as far as I know, on some of the same things that maybe Mobile Me was right. reliant on. So I think we have to break it down and look on a service by service basis is what they've been successful with.
Yeah, a company on the scale of Apple and Google, there's so many moving parts to it. They make money in so many different ways, and not all of them are consumer visible. So it's always fun to take a look at, like, if you're taking a look at Amazon and saying, oh, God, look what their profits are. Look what their money is. Well, actually, maybe they're making money off of their back end and off of their servers. And on top of all that, Google is, gosh, all their money is coming off of advertising. What happens when people advertise someplace else? Well, they're also like one of these immense, immense investment funds that basically is making money off of so many other industries and so many other companies. Even Apple, it is always alarming when you look at that pie chart. You see how big the Pac-Man of the iPhone is, and wonder what happens if Apple ever forgets why people like iPhones and doesn't come up with something new to replace it in time. But they are diversifying into so many different areas right now that it's hard to imagine a point in which, how many years could they suck before they start to go to a lesser quality of coffee in the free break room?
Is a Touch to Pay, let's talk about Apple Pay and Touch to Pay in general, is it really huge, or is it all about the future? I have conflicting articles here. This is one from the Next Web, Ben Wood's opinion piece, saying real users don't care about Apple Pay and contactless mobile payments. And he offers some statistics.
Users are real Americans. Well, I hate to split that hair, but I've watched
No, and then here's the other article. This is contactless payments surge fivefold in the UK, and Apple Pay is about to come to the UK. It's not even there right now. And they're using the same stat. They're saying half of all payments in the London Underground are contactless payments.
It's like it's amazing when I go to the U.S. and I see people. Like, there are a lot of people who cover it in the U.S. and they say how horrible it is and the nightmares that they have, and people don't know how to use the chips and it's slowing down cash registers. And I don't even remember that time in Canada. All I know is that almost anything that I do, I go in, I tap a card, and I leave. Like I tapped to pay that Tim Hortons coffee that I have here. It took 2 seconds. I tapped at another coffee shop. Someone was still trying to fish change out of their purse. I got up, ordered my coffee, got it paid, and left while they were still fishing for change. And I just never see anything else here, and I forget what it was like.
But you're an early adopter, so the question is, will normal people? Your mom uses it, okay?
Yeah, like the only thing that we have here that's a problem is that we were so early, we have a complete lack of consistency amongst user interfaces for the terminals. Right. But tap eliminates all that because you never have to see the interface; you just literally tap the card and go. And when I was in South Bay, they had those little square terminals everywhere, and I was just tapping everything in sight. And it made the transaction seamless. So I think that a lot of these might be looked at through the lens of the very painful transition in America right now, and aren't looking at what that economy looks like in Canada or the UK or something that's 5 or 10 years into this already.
I thought by now that in the US, because of the new rules from the credit card companies putting the burden on the merchants for fraud, we'd see tap to pay everywhere, and it's still far from everywhere. But you know, here's an interesting tidbit. I was at the airport with my Samsung, and so I use Samsung's Samsung Pay, which is tap to pay if the terminal's there, and if it's still a swipe terminal, you still tap, and it magically, magnetically tells it that you swiped a card. And I was in some trepidation about using it because I thought people are going to think I'm stealing from them or something.
Yeah,
but because of Samsung's incredibly prevalent ads. The first time I used it at the airport, the guy said, "Oh, it really does work everywhere, just like the ad says." And then I've used it subsequently, and everybody had seen the ad. So it was actually really easy.
Maybe that might have been why they had to run the ad, is to make sure
that
it was okay. There was actually a really interesting article. I'll see if I can find it in my history, of someone who actually was detained by store security and had the cops called on them because the way that it worked is she held her phone near the reader. It pipped,
it worked,
the receipt that was printed out said, "Okay, you've paid to your MasterCard." But the manager's like, "No, we know that you're a hacker. You had to did some sort of mojo on a thing, and we're not going to let you leave with our da 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 da." And even the cops like had to have it explained to them that no, look, here is a receipt that says that I paid for it. With the manager saying, "No, look, she suspiciously held her phone near the register."
Oh, you idiot.
Jeez. Exactly. So, and I agree with you. That's something that I all this stuff has to. There's a trust fence that has to be climbed over. That Android Pay has gotten for me, and that Apple Pay has gotten for me, because I know the technology, the chips inside it, that it's really, really super, super hard encryption. But there are a lot of people that are going to have problems in trusting that until the first time it goes. But the missing link here is that this isn't something where a whole infrastructure has to be thrown away and upgraded in order to make these things happen. Essentially, it costs about as much for these POS manufacturers to put NFC into their readers as it's not a one-to-one, but it doesn't cost them much to basically put the added hardware into and also a lot of their transactors are going to demand that their readers have the ability to do the most secure connections possible. So it really is not that much of a difference. It's just that all of these things are going to be out there in terminals, and then people are going to start to have phones that, without having to really pay any extra for it, have phones that have NFC built into it. And it's just a question of training people to want to use it. Again, I will never be, as a self-deprecating but brutally honest thing about myself, I had Android Pay in my Nexus 5 for like 9 or 10 months and had totally forgotten about it until Apple Pay came out. And that's when I wrote about it. I tested it and it worked. Okay, haha. But and then I just forgot about it. And it wasn't until Apple Pay that I reactivated what was then Google Wallet because, that's right. I've been able to do this for 10 months, but I've just totally forgotten that was an ability.
I mocked Samsung Pay when it first came out. I thought, "Oh, come on, Samsung. Who's going to use that?" Now I use it everywhere because there are lots of places still don't have tap to pay, but I can use it everywhere. And it's it's easy. Isn't it good?
Funny for me. Because here, my normal credit card, and here's my Apple credit card, and they all work the same for me because they all have that. I don't know if you can see it, but they have this little.
You have a chip wave. In there. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a wave icon, and that's an NFC. So you just tap it and you leave. And it was scary at first, but now everybody's super used to it.
It's just once you're used to it, it's just the default. I mean,
the watch still freaks people out. When I pay with my watch, like, oh my God, I've never seen a watch before. That's amazing. And then they get over it really quick.
I swear to God, that's the only thing that would make me sometimes want to have like an Apple Watch on this wrist in addition to the Android Wear, because the times over the summer last year when I was especially going through an airport where everything takes tap to pay, and I could get out of bed at 6 a.m. and check into my hotel at 4 p.m. and have bought all kinds of things and never taken my phone out of my pocket to do it once. That is the sort of that's what makes a fan out of somebody. You want to create those features that immediately and in a material way improve people's lives. This is not philosophical and it's not aspirational. It's like, no, how about instead of having to take out your wallet and take out your card, do a swipe and worry about your data being compromised, you have this thing that's 100% better. I just had to I got back from my trip to Yosemite and tried to book a hotel in D.C. for a wedding, and it wouldn't go through. And then called the bank and they said, "Oh, well, we canceled your card because your number was involved in some sort of a data breach 3 weeks ago, and I had to wait 4 days to get a brand new one." And this is why it's like we want something better than an embossed number on a mag strip, because we need something. This is that.
And Hockenberry just replaced itself. He was out one day, his watch said, "New credit card arrived," and he went and checked and said, "Oh, your old one was compromised." We automatically pushed the new one to your watch, and he was on vacation, never stopped spending.
Unfortunately, the previous time with a Home Depot breach, that happened automatically. This time, for some reason, I had to be without a card for like 3 or 4 days, and I had to now I have to manually. Go through that once, and you'll make a fan of life for tap to pay.
I want to, by the way, stand corrected. I guess Apple Pay is in the UK, but it's Barclays Bank, which for a long time wouldn't do it, now has done it. So
yeah.
After 9 months, they finally gave in.
And The Onion takes it, which everyone says is fantastic.
The Onion?
The Underground.
Oh. Well, they've had Oyster cards there for
Oyster,
a while.
Oyster, sorry, not Onion. Oyster.
You mean the Oyster?
The Oyster.
That other food.
If eventually we can be able to use, you know, instead of you just use your phone instead of using the Pasmo card or the Oyster card or the
Well, that's right. Card. Why do I need an Oyster card? Right.
Something. But I think that one of the things that they're talking about that I think would be very exciting is peer-to-peer payment. So being able to go Apple Pay to Apple Pay, I want to give somebody a little bit of money. I want to give my daughter $20 or something. She's sitting there, you know, being able to do that back and forth. Also, you know, the trust with small businesses, you know, being able to just buy stuff from them and not feel like you're giving the credit card, you know, over. And then web purchases where I don't have to get all that information from you. I'm, you know, and the question is how you do that, you know, how you set up the web purchases. It might be on mobile only at the beginning, but what if I'm, you know, linked to my computer and I'm able to hold down on my phone and it tells the computer, go ahead and make that order. And I think that a lot of those things could reduce a lot of friction when it comes to purchasing. I know that, you know, 90% of the time I order from Amazon partially because of Prime and all those other things. But a big reason is I don't want to fill all that stuff out again. they have my credit card. They have almost everything I need to order and I'm just too lazy to go try to figure it out again.
Yeah. There's so many basic concepts that are revolutionized by how good these little pocket supercomputers are, and a lot of them require us to redefine our understanding. I got a demo from a Volvo engineer of their new keyless entry system for their cars, and I agreed to the briefing because I've never I'll admit it, at least 60% because I wanted an excuse to go to New York and get into the Hamilton lottery again. okay, that's the secret.
Hey, if you pitch if I were if I York, lived as close to New York as you. I would do the same thing.
My train ride home from the wedding is like I'm taking the train because I always take the train to anywhere DC or closer, and I'm actually like I've actually scheduled the return one so that if I board the train now, I can enter the lottery at 11 a.m. while I'm in transit, and if I find out that I win at 4, I can still get off the train at New York. And anyway, so I'm getting this demo because I assumed it was you approach with your phone and there's a secure transaction. And so it knows that your phone is your key, or I tap my phone on the door handle. No, it's this amazing infrastructure they've got so that you could essentially create and distribute digital keys that have rules attached to them. So, of course, you can have, your phone be a key. That's fine. That's easy. But you can also if you've got a house guest and you're away at work and you commuted in and your house guest says, okay, borrow your car because I want to go out and run some errands, you can create a burner key for them that goes onto their phone that will be that you can revoke at any time. Or you can create a key for your kids that only works from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. And when it stops working, it's not that they'll leave them stranded, but they will not be able to start the car again with that key if they decide to go to stop at eight p.m. And even the ability to manage like a fleet of corporate cars where you can continue to create and revoke keys at will. That's such a mind freak when you grew up with the idea of a key as a physical metal object you had to go to the hardware store to have duplicated. The idea of creating something that's not only more secure than that but can be a malleable object that has rules attached to it and you can just simply disintegrate at a whim, that requires a real shift in your brain, even no matter how wonderful this thing is.
Well, and when you start realizing how much more secure it is, I mean, the idea that you have a bunch of these physical keys and you have to rekey it if you, you know, let someone go, that was scary, you know, and, you know, all of those things are when you start rethinking all of that, we're in the process of, you know, we were getting, you know, we have a lot of locks right now. We were going to get, you know, we're looking at passes with fobs and each one of those things is thousands of dollars. Yep. And I was like, we're just going to do this with our phones. I mean, I'm not going to keep on, you know, going down that path.
Is there such a thing? Because the new studio, we should do that. So there is like touch security.
Yeah, there's definitely security where you can, I mean, you can do it even when you get close. We're not looking at the outer door, which is a little bit more secure. But once you get in, deciding where you can get to in the office and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of lock systems that are already built. Now, we're actually replacing some of the doors with a couple of things. And so when we do that, we're going to build it in and we're still trying to decide which lock we want to use. Autumn makes one that I've been playing with in my house. But there's a couple other solutions.
We use fobs right now, but boy, it'd be great.
I'm done. At first I thought I was going to be done with keys by the end of this year. And now I'm really focused on being done with like everything except for maybe my car. I'm going to maybe get a Tesla. So I have to wait. For, you know, 10 years to actually have a car.
Did you get on that list?
I haven't gotten on the list yet. Forget it.
It's too late now. It's like 300. No, you'd be number 300,000.
I did it 3 minutes in, so I'm going to be like 3 months later. Did you do it? Absolutely.
Nice.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I saw the number. I was like, oh, right, I was supposed to do that. And then I saw the number, and I was like.
It's probably easier to get a Hamilton ticket at this point.
Probably easier to get a mall, yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be. It's going to be interesting. I would not be buying futures of oil right now. That's all I can say.
Can I ask you a question though? Did you get that? Did you put down that $1,000 deposit because you intend to buy a Tesla, or basically as a way to, if you want to buy a Tesla a year from now, you'll be able to get one, but still you'll be able to get your $1,000 back if you decide that you don't want one.
A year for? I was thinking like in 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, try 2020. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and by then I
came so close to putting down that deposit for that reason. So
no, like, that's a perfectly good reason. Yeah,
but it's like,
I mean, when
it's
you think
thousand
about
bucks
it,
though, that's the problem. Like, they have your thousand.
Does Elon Musk need an interest free loan from a freelance journalist? That's all I was asking.
Greatest
myself.
Kickstarter in history.
Hey, when I ordered the X, that was even though it was $5,000, that kind of was the idea. Was well, I guess I can get it back if I don't want it. Because it is refundable right up to the point where they start making it.
Well, I mean, if you look at it, you can actually put your $1,000 down and go through an entire other lease with a whole other car.
Yep. Right. And then get your new car.
Yeah, exactly.
I just want to know if I can trade it in for my Apple car in 5 years or just the deposit maybe.
You know, the thing that's kind of interesting about the Model 1 and Model 3 and Tesla and Elon's tweets have kind of indicated this. It's got a very weird dashboard. There is no dashboard. There's no speedometer. There's no controls. It's all on one computer, one 15-inch computer screen in the middle of the dash. And a number of people have, including Tim, I'm going to say Sweezy again. I don't know why. Tim Stevens of theroadshow.com on Twit this Sunday said he thinks it might be that this will be a fully autonomous vehicle.
He said that about the X, right? That the X was really ideal as
the X has the capability.
Taxi. Yeah.
Well, and I think that
thinking by 2018 or 19, when you get your Model 3, it might be time for fully autonomous.
Well, I don't know if it needs to be fully autonomous. I don't know if I'd want to buy a car that was fully autonomous, but I do like the idea that the driver, whatever.
Would you buy a car that had no speedometer? There's no gauges. Did you look at the dashboard?
That screen can hold a gauge.
But it's over there.
I know, but you don't need to know it at every moment. And I think that, but I think that specifically the issue is that what I'm really interested in is I'll drive the country roads. I'll drive all. I don't need you to figure that out. What I really just want to do is once I get on the highway and I get into it, you know, I just want you to just figure this out. And I'm going to go back to tweeting, you know, or texting or whatever.
The VR is all around you.
Exactly. I'm going to put a VR goggles on and you tell me when I need to pick up the drive again. But the point is that I think that it is, and you talk to most of these engineers, they'll tell you that it's getting off the highway. Most of them will tell you the highway is very easy to manage. You know, as far as, you know, how that system works, it's all the side streets and it's all the things that can happen with pedestrians and it's all the potholes. You know, those are the things that make it really complicated. And so I think that it's much faster to market to have something that you can control. And I think Google is swallowing a lot, I mean, you know, to try to take it all on. And I'm not that, I think that's going to be a harder sell to the consumer that I'm never going to be able to actually grab onto the steering wheel that bothers me.
We can get there incrementally, though. I haven't had to have an ungodly highway commute, but there was a year and a half where I had to drive like an hour and a half to and back and total of 3 hours a day, like 3 to 5 times a week to visit somebody. Boy, you get into that place where my brain is home, but my body and my car are still 38 minutes away from my driveway. This is bad. And if I were in that position where I had that kind of commute, I would buy a car that only worked on highways, where if you could just simply say, okay, now that we're on the highway and at speed, please take over, keep me in my lane, keep me from getting into an accident, and then alert me when we're 10 miles or 5 miles from my exit, which is the point where I will take over and do all the local driving. If we had one lane, let's say a dedicated lane that was just for autonomous vehicles, where everybody in this lane is not a jerk, they're not drunk, they're not angry, and they don't take it personally that someone is two car lengths ahead of them, I think that would be the fastest moving lane.
Well, and I think at some point, I talked about this in a couple episodes ago, where, you know, they're going to eventually want cars to drive themselves as a mandatory thing, because I think on the side streets that'll take a long time, but I could definitely see a point on a highway where you can't enter certain highways without being
autonomous active.
Yeah. You know, like you can't enter this highway without being, because there's some highways right now that you can't get on if you don't have a fast track, you know, in some.
We had an autonomous vehicle expert, I think it was, I can't remember who it was, but on the new screensavers, who said where you're going to see it first is in the highly congested downtown areas. They already have no drive zones in many big cities, right? And so what you'll do is you'll get to the perimeter of the no drive zone in Manhattan or San Francisco, and you'll just get into a Uber autonomous vehicle to get the rest of the way.
I honestly believe that the next important revolution is to make it as hard and inconvenient and as expensive as possible to drive a car in the city.
That's already happened. Have you not been to the city?
I'm serious. You have. No, exactly.
It's obvious. It's like almost.
Even as a kid, I would do almost anything to avoid having to drive through downtown.
It's horrible.
But the thing is, you have to basically. Convince people that the only reason why I'm going to take a car into this really congested area is because there is absolutely no alternative and it's definitely worth it. And you, of course, have to back that up by saying that we're going to make sure we give you the best public transportation network that exists to make sure that you wouldn't even want to, even if it were only the second circle of hell and not the sixth circle of hell driving into Boston. We're going to make it so that, well, why would you want to do that? I'm feeling that myself, where it's like when I first moved here, which was not, it's farther away from Boston than I've ever lived. But I would have to drive like about 45 minutes. If I had a meeting in town, I have to drive like 45 to 50 minutes to pick up a train someplace else. And then the commuter rail extended a couple of stops. And now I could do that same thing, but I'd much rather rearrange my entire day so that my commute consists of a 45-minute walk or 20-minute bike ride to commuter rail. And then I do nothing for an hour. It's better. I don't care if it's cheaper. I don't care if it's better for the environment. It's, I just like it more, even if it takes even a little bit more time to do it. That's the next revolution. Not figure out whether you get more cars in and out of the city, but to remove parking spaces and turn two lanes in the middle of a city to one lane of cars and a green lane for pedestrians, wheeled vehicles, and electric vehicles less than 20 miles an hour. Make it so compelling to not drive that people will prefer to not drive.
When we're training people to do 3D, for instance, or, you know, 3D production, actual, you know, animation and so on and so forth, one of the things we have to just beat into them, and it often takes, you know, almost physical beating, is that it doesn't matter how long it takes as long as you're not there, as long as you're not doing it. So the thing is that you do all the things you want to be. Everything should be very interactive and very easy, and you should keep your texture map small and your renders small and everything else so that you can move quickly and iterate. And then when you go home at night, I don't care if it takes 12 hours, or we can run it on 40 computers and have it done tomorrow or whatever. But the point is that, you know, I don't care how long my trip to San Francisco is if I'm not fully dedicated to exactly. it. And I think that that's what people really care about.
That's why I'm taking, there's DC is the border between my flying and taking the train, because actually I can get, there's a regional airport that has direct flights, and it actually will take me 3 hours longer to get there. But it's the difference between, do I want to sit in a comfortable train for 6 hours, walk around, have my notebook, have internet access, get a snack whenever I want it, or do I want to have the hour and a half, 2 hour flight bookended by an hour of crap that I don't want to have to deal with? Quality of experience counts.
That entire corridor is anything from Boston to DC, any of those cities in between, I'm only going to use the train because it's so great. And for some reason, I've really gotten a taste for those little burgers.
You got to put the infrastructure there. People will use it. And the funny thing is, where you see more people on a bicycle or on foot as you're driving past them, you take it into your mind that, wow, it is possible to actually ride a bicycle. I see someone who is just as middle-aged and lumpy and out of shape as I am, who is on a bicycle, and they don't appear to be dying, and little kids don't appear to be like chasing them and throwing bruised apples at them and making fun of them. Maybe I should try riding a bicycle sometime. Again, put it out there. And that's why I keep saying that I don't think that I would be disappointed if all Apple did with electric vehicles was they have made their own electric car. That's not a big idea. That's an obvious idea. And that's just basically entering into a market with a lot of different people. I want them to create a solution that solves a problem. Like, again, creating a $1,000 or $1,500 electric bicycle that's so cool that everybody will want to get this instead of a second car.
Instead of making a bicycle for the mind, they could make a bicycle for your ass.
Exactly.
In Montreal, we did that.
That was the logo. Wheels for your ass. Now, perfect. Perfect. Now that Apple is 40, these are the things that are more on its mind.
We're getting old and lumpy too.
We're happy with the time we spent trying to change the world and inspire people. Now our ass is dragging right now.
We just want to make a bike now.
Wheels for the ass.
Make it a tricycle. Actually, as long as you're at it.
That domain is available.
Let's take a break. We're going to come back with more. I have a new video from Duncan Sinfield. He is the guy who has been slowly videoing the building of the Apple campus every month. A new video every month, a more major production. This time, not only 4K, but Tim Cook makes an appearance. It's gotten crazy. Well,
running outside, shaking a broom.
Stop it! Go away with your drone, kids!
Deploy the anti-drones. The drone defense system.
Waving a bro saying, all right, kids, I warned you. You're not getting this Frisbee back. You play ball in your own neighborhood.
You kids, get off of my campus. Our show today brought to you by Wealthfront. Someday you're going to be an old coot like me. And when you get there, you're going to be glad you put some money aside for the long term, doing a little savings for your retirement, the kids' college fund, maybe a down payment on a house. You know, there's lots of stuff you should be saving for, at least for a rainy day, you know? And but the question is, well, how do you do that? Are you going to put it in your mattress? No, of course you're not going to do that. Are you going to, put it in the savings account or a CD? Have you looked at rates lately? It almost seems like you're paying them for the privilege of using the bank. All right. Well, I think investing, right? That's the way to make money. Nowadays, you got to put money in the market, into bonds, into stocks. Well, That's tricky, because if you're going to do it right, you got to read a lot and study it up. And I did that. I read all the books. I read The Random Walk Down Wall Street, Burton Malkiel's a classic, and Charles D. Ellis's Investor's Guide. And, you know, there's lots of great stuff out there. You study it all up like that, the winning the losers game. But it's not just reading those books and buying the right stuff to start with. Then you have to monitor it and continually rebalance it and think about it. And, you know, 10 years later, I kind of looked at my investments and went, oh, I probably should have paid closer attention to them. Oh, okay, I got it. I got it. We're going to go out. We're going to get a pro. We're going to get an expert to do this. We're going to go down the street and get a stock advisor. You know how much you pay those guys, the financial advisors? Between 1% and 3% of what they manage every year. That means you would have to make 3% more to break even. And that is not easy. So this is what I want you to do. Take a look at Wealthfront. This is really a good idea. Those guys I mentioned, Charles Ellis and Burton Malkiel, they're on the advisory board. They help put the software together. Yeah, it's software that keeps an eye on your account, not just, you know, every 3 months when you come visit, but all the time, every minute of every day. They rebalance. This is based on not only the best investment practices and Nobel Prize winning academic research, but you got to read about this because it's very sophisticated stuff. I can't remember what they call it. There's a name for this. But all of this costs you so little because it's a computer. What, a computer doesn't need much? A 1/4 of 1% a year. Nothing. And never any additional charges for transactions or hidden fees. They've got a new thing. You can go there right now. This, I would do this anyway. Go to wealthfront.com/MacBreak and do the portfolio review. Show them what you're investing in right now and see how, you know, what they think, how diversified it is, what you're losing to fees. That's an eye-opener. Minimize your taxes. If you decide to invest, and by the way, I want you to read this all, and, you know, you've heard the disclaimers, read before investing, but I really think that's true. You want to understand what they're doing. But you can get started with as little as $500. And they're doing something really nice for MacBreak listeners. If you sign up to invest at wealthfront.com/MacBreak, they're going to manage your first $15,000 free of charge forever. Not 0.25%, but zero. Wealthfront.com/MacBreak. I've heard from so many of you who've heard the ads, who've tried it, and who are really happy. I really think you got to try it. Essie, you're going to say, oh, well, Leo, are you using it? I can't. SEC regulations prohibit customers from doing testimonials on advertisements for products like this. So I would be. So they told us you can't do it. Wealthfront.com/MacBreak. Your free portfolio analysis waiting for you and a great deal for your future. You'll be an old coot like me someday soon. And you can look back and thank your present day self and say, young me, you were smart. You did a good thing. Wealthfront.com/MacBreak. There was an article in the journal just a couple of weeks ago I noted that said that human investment advisors are terrified because the computers do so much. Frankly, they do so much of a better job. And it's like, whoa.
If they can win at Go, if they can win at chess, they can win at this.
Right. This is easy compared to Go.
Yeah.
That gets back to what we were talking about earlier. When we were all kids just entering the workforce, you have to go inside a bank and you have to do a really grown-up thing, which is to start an investment strategy at age 19 or age 20 and planning it. So you don't have a suit, you don't have a tie. It's so intimidating. As opposed to, like, if I were young now and just, I heard someone recommended this thing on Reddit or I saw this ad and just, well, screw around with it. Gee, I got my ski trip just got canceled. I got $400 that I don't know what to do with. Let's see what happens with this. Boy, I would have started planning so much earlier if I had this sort of stuff.
I know. There's a lot. And you could do it on your phone. You don't even have to sit down. You could do it in the subway.
Even just the banking app on my phone. I don't like banking. I don't like numbers. I don't like that sort of thing. And it wasn't until I had the ability to simply at the drop of a hat, check my balances and move money around and do stuff like that, that I really was checking my accounts at least once a day. It used to be at the worst once a month when I opened up all those envelopes that I hate to open. Mm-hmm. So, God, mm-hmm. you just love – we talk about microprocessors. We talk about nanometers. We talk about devices. But it really is these little changes in the way that big things can be handled that is the real revolution.
Let's watch Duncan Sinfeld. He's at it again. Post these every month. Apple Campus 2. This is the April 2016 update. And for some, I'll turn on the music too. For some reason, he's decided to include Tim Cook's. Many people.
It's something that Apple has
talking about the campus
for over 40 years.
Is this from the most recent event?
Probably
it is.
The last product introduction in the town hall that you're sitting in today. We've had a lot of important announcements.
Feel free to take a seat with you. Very. He's just ripped it up like a Who concert.
Was announced in this room.
Yeah, that room has a lot of history. The iPod socks were announced in that room.
Next year, in 2017, we're looking forward to moving.
So that's, by the way, that means the iPhone 7 announcement will still be somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
They need a big venue.
Yeah. Although this one's coming along, this town hall. They've got the roof on now. Looks pretty, doesn't it?
Although that's interesting. Maybe I should correct myself. Maybe wouldn't it be interesting if they decided we're going to complete the hall first?
Right.
Especially because you would expect it to be not quite so deep inside. That would be interesting.
The roof is on. And what better way to kind of showcase the progress they're making on the campus than to have a bunch of journalists come? And and as far as I could tell, it's close to the road. I mean, it's not like you have to drive through this.
Yeah, yeah.
to get there. Look at that. All the underground parking.
They don't want to get any journalists on them while they're building, Leo.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. All I got to say is you watch this and you're just like, this is going to be the coolest place.
I know. Well, this and then the new Gigafactory that Tesla's building, which is what did Elon Musk say? The largest freestanding building in the world?
Yep.
I mean, amazing.
Have you seen Google's like new campus where it's just... It's like a establishing shot in a movie that's set in 2117.
Yeah.
It's like we have to aggressively point out, you see how no buildings today look even remotely like that? It would be impractical for absolutely anything.
Yeah, exactly. Although Google got cut back, you know, the city of Mountain View cut them way back. So Google's ambitions are a little bit less.
Only on Earth, Leo. The orbital station is tough.
I know. You now know why Larry Page wants an island. He's doing more before and after now. This is October. This is the theater, but the lid's on that now. You see, the theater's underground, and the round part is the lobby, which gives you apparently a 360.
It's like an Apple store, like a big staircase glass that you go down into the theater.
Man, I gotta really start to kiss ass over at Apple.
I was thinking more like I want my first exposure to this to be like visiting a friend there, because if it's an event, I will actually have like 81 hours of work to do in 4 hours of time. Yeah. I every time I've been there, I've been lucky to just have like 10 minutes in the store. I want to just have nothing to do but to walk around and try to look as Apple-y as possible so that they don't. Say, you, there he is, get him out of here.
I want to find the Mario Kart track that I know is at the bottom of that loop.
Actually, you know, I've been in the Apple campus numbers of times after my whatever that is that I don't get invitations anymore. I've met with the iTunes people. They love us. Steve, hi. Yeah. And so I probably can get down there somehow.
Leo, did you see the report last week from New York Times about Google and Apple being the high-tech hippies of the Silicon Valley?
Yeah. Not silicone. Let's get it right.
Silicon Valley.
they're not made of rubber.
Talking about all the construction projects they're doing.
Yeah. But see, it's unfortunate because that is not what the Google campus is going to end up looking like now, because Mountain View shut them down. There's only going to be one building, The tent's not going to be quite the same.
Didn't HP say they're going to make a much thinner building?
Thinner, lighter building.
Actually, I sent this to you, Jason Kleanthis, because I know you're in the market for a Windows PC. Shame on you.
I know.
But HP just announced a new laptop that is kind of pretty.
It's very pretty.
It's thinner than anything else. They say now the world's thinnest laptop, and it's coppery. On the only thing wrong, you have to run Windows 10 on it.
Yeah. And also, it's like $1,300.
you need an external pull-out antenna to get through the copper shielding. Yeah. I didn't really think that one through.
No, they only coppered that part, that little back part.
This is very much a Apple video that they're showing. And by the way, totally a MacBook ripoff.
The thinnest notebook that we've ever made.
The thinnest notebook we've ever made! Come on!
A marriage of engineering.
You need a guy with an English accent if you're going to say that.
Chamfer. Say the word chamfer.
Chamfer. I do like the hinges.
Yeah.
And notice, by the way, Type-C ports.
Three of them.
Three of them.
So great.
We had a
new team member join iMore yesterday, Michael Gartenberg, previously of Apple, and he did one of his first articles on competing with Apple. And he said, you know, Apple often does really great design, and they figure out what the product needs. Is it battery life? Is it a good size? And is it, you know, but the competitors tend to focus on one dimension. So you're going after Apple on thinness, but is that the thing that people care most about, and what are you sacrificing to get there?
Yeah, this is pretty...
It's hard to compare the two, though, because remember that Apple is the only manufacturer of these devices. They don't compete with anybody. And anytime HP makes a line of notebooks, they have to basically make every notebook that everybody could possibly want.
Yeah.
So you got to make a Spectre line of notebooks for people who want to have a really great notebook to carry into a meeting that bespeaks their authority and their position within the company. But then you also need to make the blister pack of 12 that costs $450, but can still run all the apps that need to be run.
How did they get the Spectre license? Nothing but sympathy. Before James Bond did. Like, I mean, they were doing Spectre again.
They've been making Spectres forever.
The only thing I wonder is it doesn't have touch. It's not a touch screen.
Side-firing speakers, which I like, you know, the stereo.
I like these Spectre devices. I've had a couple of them in for review, and they were not enough to make me sway from Apple, from Mac, for any reason. But nonetheless, it's like if I ever had to move to Windows and I wanted the most MacBook-like experience, this would be close to it. Although they make some dumb mistakes.
Nice too.
They made a dumb mistake in one of their earlier ones like a year or two ago where they had a caps lock key or a power key it was the light on the keyboard, I think, for the backlighting that was like to show you that the backlighting is off. But if you want the backlighting on, here it is. But it was so piercingly bright that it would just... And then they actually had to release, I think it was actually a firmware update to give people the ability to disable it because it was like,
I think I still have Dell and Lenovo on timeout for their man in the middle attacks on their own users. So I think HP is a safe one for me to buy. Right now.
You know, HP's famous for junking them up, but
they all junk them up. But at least there was no certificate abuse.
Just get your Windows 10 disk and reinstall everything. Or better yet, just be a nice Linux machine.
Hey, what? Gen 2, Noco, Patent Frelio.
I know. I have to say,
Chromium.
Nowadays, we always make a joke about Linux on the desktop. But, you know, it's pretty good. Even though they're adding the Bash shell to Windows, which is bizarre.
Did we talk about the Safari early access thing they released last week?
Tell me about that.
The purple? So previously you could get the WebKit nightly bills, but that was not... You know, for normal people, that would, you know, you had to really want those to go and install them and put up with bugs. But now they have an early access program to new Safari features. And I forget the exact name, but you basically get a purple Safari icon on your dock and it gives you whatever they're working on for the next version of Safari.
It's like the
public beta program. So you can get the latest, greatest WebKit.
Do you have to be a developer to do that?
No, I believe it's totally open. I mean, they made a very public page for it. I love when they do this because the web really is, you know, the most communal of things. And Apple hasn't always gotten things out as fast as some of the other people
in the community
would like. Yeah, it's like Samuel Jackson purple. It's awesome.
Safari technology preview.
It, yeah.
This is it? All right. And you just download it. Well, heck, you know, I don't mind being on the bleeding edge.
And you can update it through the App Store, which makes it really easy for like normal people to do it.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I mean, Google's done this for ages. They actually, Google has three levels of Chrome. You can get Chrome, Chrome Beta, and then Chrome, what they call Canary, which is like really early release. I think that's...
So you can still get WebKit Nightlies, but if you want something a little bit friendlier, you can get this.
How do you get WebKit Nightlies? Do you have to...
WebKit.org.
Okay, so you have to get those like from the website. Yeah.
I also want to point out that Linux is an option, but Chromium is also a really good option. The Just like with Android, Google releases binaries, source files for the Chromium operating system, the stuff they run on Chromebooks. And why would you want to turn like a $2,000, MacBook into a Chromebook? But if you have a MacBook that's 4 or 5 years old, it's not fast enough to run anything cool in the Mac space right now, but you can take it off the shelf and turn it into a Chromium-based machine and make it fast, run all the different modern web apps, all the different modern Chromium apps. And instead of this thing just collecting dust on a shelf or, God forbid, giving it away to a charity, your kid can actually have a working machine that, you know, that still has your fingerprints and your arm hairs lodged underneath the keyboard.
No, in fact, I use that on all my Linux installs. Probably shouldn't, but I do because it's got a, I can just log in and it's got all my bookmarks and all my extensions. And it's at least as functional as Chrome OS right away. And then I can, install whatever else I need. You do need, by the way, she mentioned for Safari Purple, you need, which is, I think, my new name for it. You got to get 10.11.4. This came out just a couple of days ago.
Yeah, along with 9.3.1, I think.
Yeah, so 9.3.1 fixed that weird Safari link bug in iOS.
Yeah, if you had the Bookings app installed, it would overflow.
Oh, it was just that overflow app? Because I haven't seen it. Yeah. So, okay, that's why. So somebody called me up and said, I can't, do I need to install it? And I said, no, you don't need to install it. It's just that one bug. And it's even better than that. You don't need to install it unless you have the Bookings app installed.
Yeah, you might as well, because you'll eventually upgrade to stuff anyway. But totally. And that's why it was so flummoxing, because we could never reproduce it. And it turned out it was just because none of us had Bookings app installed.
So weird. As for 10.11.4, this is a full upgrade, right? This is something everybody should do.
It's a point, really, which always includes everything, like from security fixes to bugs and, it's almost a cliche now, bug and performance improvements.
We had mentioned a few of these, the ability to import Evernote into Notes. They're really beefing up Notes. They have now passcode-protected Notes.
Yep.
You could share live photos between iOS and OS X via AirDrop and Messages.
I really wish some of this stuff would go system-wide. It's like you can use the Touch ID or a password to protect individual notes, not the Notes app itself, but individual notes. But it'd be super handy if you could require passcode or Touch ID to launch the Messages app, the Photo app, the Notes app, any one that you choose. Just make it a setting in the app settings for each one and toggle them on.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of fixes you can see, and I presume some security fixes as well. So download it. You know what? I installed it on my other machines, but they're not pinging you necessarily. And do they wait a few days before they say you should get it?
It's if you have it set to automatic, it'll do it automatically. Otherwise, I think when you go to the Mac App Store, you'll see it. Or you might get that little notification window that comes up that says you have updates to install.
I forgot to do it on here. I just, So where do I turn it on that it should do that in the system?
For automatic or for?
Automatic. I want to get them all automatically.
I believe that's in the settings for the Mac App Store. I'll just go and double check.
App Store. Yeah, see, look, I have it, and it still didn't do that. Automatically check for updates, download in the background, install, yes. Install.
It did it for me. I told it to ask me, and it keeps asking me every day. And it keeps asking me while I'm doing a show like this, so I keep saying no later tonight.
Yeah, that's probably a good reason not to do it automatically, but I have it turned on, and I did not get pinged. I had forgotten that I hadn't done it on this machine, so. Anyway, I'm doing it now.
Do you leave any of your devices on automatic? Because, I mean, that's the one thing don't do.
Yeah,
I do. I always want to be able to...
What are you going to do? Yeah, so. Come on, Alex. What are you going to do? What are you going to look at it and go,
No, it's mostly the time. I just don't want to do it. It's mostly just that I just don't want to do it during a show or during an upload or, I'm at an event.
I think it ever kind of does it automatically, right? It'll ask you before it does it, right?
Well, no, if you have automatic updates on your iPad, it's just going to start. It'll
just start.
Just starts.
It'll do it at night. I think it prioritizes doing it at night when it thinks you're no longer using the device.
Is night shift on? Okay, let's update.
It was such a brouhaha about people angry that night shift doesn't turn on when you're in low power mode.
But I don't know if night shift saves power. It's yellow.
It uses power. Yeah, so it uses power for several reasons, one of which I suspect is that it's not native and that it's actually rendering it. Right. Also, some people pointed out that you have to actually boost the LCD because you're removing a bunch of blue light, which is the easiest one for it to do luminance with.
Yeah,
so it's boosting that as well. And also because either it runs off location services to know when sunset, sunrise are going, or off a background process for the timer. And all these things add up. And one of them doesn't sound like a lot, but when you have a bunch of these things going, and the whole point of low power mode is to stop everything that's completely not necessary.
The only reason I've been using it is because it's the first time I could white balance my iPad for our over-the-head shot on iOS today. And so our producers, Anthony Nielsen, said, oh, that's good. It looks white now. It used to look blue. I use it for white balance, but I actually hate it at night. I don't want to look at a yellowed-out screen. It looks like parchment paper.
Like a pirate.
Like a pirate. I'm looking at a map. A map.
I just like the visual reminder that, dude, it's 11 o'clock.
Go to bed.
Are you really going to be reading your iPad for the next 4 hours?
Yes. Yes. Do you mind?
Someone is wrong on the internet, Andy.
Yeah.
They need you. Go get them. Foxconn bought Sharp. Doesn't Sharp make all of the panels for Apple displays, the cinema displays?
One of them. Apple often multi-sources for displays now. And you have, Samsung and Sharp, and I forget the third one.
Oh, okay.
LG. And it depends on any given product what that mix looks like.
Oh, okay. So that's not a big deal. Foxconn's a good partner for Apple anyway. It is interesting, though, that this company, which was really just a manufacturing company, is now turning into a supercomputer superpower.
Well, it is making a little bit of money.
Well, a little bit of money too, but they're doing okay. Harry McCracken wrote a great article in Fast Company in honor of Apple's 40th last Friday with Regis McKenna's notebooks.
That was incredible.
Handwritten notebooks, yeah.
Handwritten notebooks. So Regis is the PR guru that Steve Jobs went to in 1976 when he started Apple Computer and really had a great partnership with the Apple for a long time, helping position the company. I love this. He's got a rubber stamp that says "Return to Regis McKenna himself."
And that was his actual title at the company. On his business cards, it said Regis McKenna himself.
Oh, that's hysterical! Because the company's named Regis McKenna. So
yeah, that's when a designer was just like dummying up some cards and showing for his proof. Oh, that's great. I want my title to be myself.
It's like Galactica Actual.
Yeah, this is so. He had worked for Intel, helping Intel popularize the microcomputer. Here's a note from 1972. What is a microcomputer? How do you use it? Typical applications. And from that, of course, one of his ads in 1973 showing all the typical applications or the ways you might use a microcomputer. So he helped Apple. And it's funny, the notebook, he says, just met with the Steve Jobs guy. This is actually an email. But this is not from Regis. This is from somebody named Don. I met with Steve Jobs at Apple in his garage. Then Steve visited our office. He's 21, along with a 25-year-old partner. Steve has designed, manufactured, and is marketing a microprocessor system, the Apple One computer. His first ad is attached. It'll appear in Interface in July. And then Harry, great. Good on you, Harry. Found the ad. This is an Apple One ad. See that with the original Ron Wayne logo of Sir Isaac Newton and the apple falling on his head? $666.66, and a typo in the first sentence.
No, Mister, make sure the other side of the fence is painted just as well as the front side.
Yeah, maybe he learned that. It says the Apple One system, if a fully assembled, tested, and burned-in microprocessor board. I think he meant is. A typo. Wow.
No red squiggly lines back then.
Mm. Yeah, they probably had set that in hot lead. Sorry, Mr. Jobs, it'll cost you $1.50 to fix that. It wasn't easy for Jobs and Woz to get to meet with Regis McKenna himself. But once he did, I think he kind of was inspired by what they were up to. And look at the notebook, so fun. You can, Harry's made it so you can blow it up. I don't know where Harry got him. Did he go to Regis and say, give me your notebooks? I don't know. It's pretty cool. Bit of history. Bit of Apple history. And there's Regis himself with Steve Jobs in the 80s. That was another thing Bill Atkinson did. He brought the famous picture of Bill. This was shot 2 weeks before the Apple Macintosh was released. Cross-legged, holding a Mac. Bill, of course, got curly hippie hair and a big fluffy mustache, and Jobs is sitting next to him. Both of them are shoeless. They're in their stocking feet, both cross-legged on the floor. And Bill Atkinson yesterday says, look at Steve's look, because he's kind of looking at him like this. He's thinking, He says, Steve's thinking, how can I use this? There it is. How can I use this guy to my advantage? Even Bill Atkinson said that, which is great.
Yeah.
He said, for 2 years, I had more dinners with Steve than not. It was like 2 years we were joined at the hip. We were close, close friends. And then Jobs was fired, famously, started Next, asked Atkinson to come to Next. Bill said, I was working on HyperCard at Apple, and I didn't want to leave. I wanted to finish HyperCard. So I said, Steve, I want to finish. I'm going to stay because I want to finish HyperCard. Jobs said, if you were my friend, you'd come with me.
Yeah.
And Bill said yesterday, he said, I wanted to say, he said, I think he did say it. If you were my friend, you'd want me to do what is making me happy and finish HyperCard. Yeah. And they didn't talk again for 7 years.
Wow.
But he, could tell he loved you, Steve. He's teared up a little bit when he was talking about
it. And Steve actually said, well, you can do HyperCard at Next. And he said back that, well, Macs have how many million? Yeah. How many Macs out there versus how many Next machines get?
Although, and so, in hindsight, maybe it would have done better because Apple killed it. When Steve came back, he killed HyperCard because Bill said it had the stink of Scully all over it.
Well, it's that, hard to wash that too, off. But he was also saying that Apple did not have the ability to support as many projects as it was supporting.
But that was very short sighted because HyperCard.
Well, and whether it's HyperCard or not, I think that one of the big things is missing. I think Apple is trying to make this all more accessible. We've gone from Objective-C to Swift. But I think what's really missing is some kind of the next generation of Visual Basic or whatever, which is that there is a, you know, I have nodal connections that I can write my own program and I can compile it. You know, and I think that that would, HyperCard for me when I was much younger was, you know, a way to just kind of hack out ideas. I didn't have to figure out all the syntax and everything else. I could just, my program we were talking about before the show, I programmed a whole radio station with it, did all the music rotations and all the ads and all the PSAs and like all, everything was all run through this thing. And I would work on it every day after I got off the air. I would just go, oh, I didn't like that. And, you know, and I'd run a update every night, you know, and it was just very, very easy to, you know, to throw ideas together and make them very visual. And I think that it is a missing thing for Apple now, you know, to have something like that. I think Automator goes some direction towards that, which, you know, but I think having a real, like, programming interface that lets you do a lot of those things and then actually compile it would be really a useful direction.
I didn't ask Bill because, you know, you don't want to put somebody in the spot about something that they can't change. But I thought maybe if he'd gone with Next, stayed with Steve, HyperCard would have survived in some form or fashion.
What about just spitballing here? Swift, you have REPL, you have Playground, and then Swift Cards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apple?
Still not as easy as HyperCard. But
well, if they do like the whole interface for it and then maybe put it on iOS, just wondering.
You know what Atkinson said, and you would agree, I think, with this, Alex Lindsay. He said the spiritual successor to HyperCard is Apple's iBooks author. Mm-hmm.
It is. I think that it's just not as programmable. I mean, I don't think you can do the kind of things that I did with HyperCard. With
you wouldn't run a radio station in iBook Author.
Right. Well, I mean, and again, like, I had proposed to a software company in the early 90s because I was really into HyperCard. I just did everything. You know, I just managed my life inside of HyperCard. And I said, we should just write your next manual inside of HyperCard. You know, like the whole manual should just be so. And when iBooks came out, I really saw it as that was something that
you were very excited. Yeah.
Yeah. And
what is the status now? I mean, it's still out there. It's free. You can create a book and publish it on iBooks. But good. Are people using it?
Yeah, there are definitely people using it. A lot of schools are using it. I think that what I don't think Apple really has taken advantage of or just didn't really understand, I think, about its own product. I think a lot of companies will build something and they have a certain vision for it and then it gets used for something else and they just don't understand what to do with that. So it was not successful in getting the big publishers to move their content because they were kind of new wine and old wineskins and it was just kind of this, like, they don't understand what to do with that. And they did some stuff with Apple pushing them to do it and it just barely used what it could do. What it really took off was it was this incredible tool for teachers to build their curriculum on.
My dad uses it. He's a professor of geology. He made an incredible course on Darwin and the Beagle.
Yeah, and you know, HyperCard.
a person I've known a long time that's been in the Pixel Core, Tony Farley, you know, teaches in San Leandro, and he's using iBook to build whole books, and he's got all kinds of stuff, and he's actually published some of them. And the thing is that for
that's pretty cool. Yeah, because you can do your whole curriculum in there.
Yeah, and that has turned out to be a huge growth area. I think that I do think that Apple has not invested because it didn't do what they thought it should do. I think that they haven't invested the kind of resources that I really believe they should. I think they should be tripling down instead of trying to figure out how to get publishers, you know, how to organize publishers so they can charge more for their, you know, regular old paper books that were scanned into whatever. You know, what we should really be thinking about is how do we just redefine how books are made and really spend a lot of energy and resources and development funds in the way that, you know, companies are spending, you know, they'll spend money to say, well, we will fund, you know, outrageous or really cool uses of our technology. There's a huge fund to build plugins for Slack, you know, that Slack pays, you know, to do that, you know. And in the same way, I think Apple should be looking for people doing, you know, building inventive things and really giving people the engineering resources to make that work, because they could, rather than trying to compete with Amazon, just create a whole nother playing field that doesn't look like that at all. Because, you know, books, we don't really want books to look like books in 10 years. I mean, you know, like we want them to be something, you know, that's interactive and has video and 3D and that's all easy to develop. And, you know, that's, you know, and I think that Apple's really missing the boat in that area. And again, I think that there's also a huge programming opportunity. You know, iBooks could be that, but I think that you really could build a visual programming interface that lets people take their ideas and visually build them without having to understand all the code. And maybe there gets to a point where they have to understand the code, you know, where they have to, you know, but I think that building some kind of programming interface that people could do more visually, I think would create another explosion in people solving, problems, you know, for their own, you know, for their own business.
Bill said something yesterday that I've always agreed with. Oftentimes people, even like in an official capacity, say, "Why we were considering like proposing that our school board make programming courses mandatory?" And I always say the same thing, that you got it the wrong way around. That you should teach kids that here is a problem you want to solve. Here is the box of tools available to you for solving it, as opposed to today we're going to learn how to program in this language.
Well, isn't that great?
HyperCard was so good because it basically is, what problem do you want to solve? Here's a toolbox for doing it. And you learn how to script when you reach a point where I can't do this thing that I want to make this thing do right now. That's when you start to get into HyperTalk. But until then, you can just add cards, draw fields, draw buttons, link buttons to fields. And that's why it was such a brilliant backdoor into teaching people how to program, because it's never about, even as a kid, I was coding like hours and hours and hours every single day. So and it was never because I had an interest in 6502 assembler language. It's because I wanted to make animation that worked better than I could get it to work on in Apple Soft Basic.
See, that's funny, because that's the difference maybe between you and me, because I have only ever been interested in technology for its own sake, not as a tool at all. It's a toy. It's fun for me. It's interesting for me. And the coding, I have written code that's used as a tool, but really the coding was the journey for me, not the tool itself. That's kind of how I approached technology. And maybe I'd have been more creative and better had I not. But
it's always for me. It's always definitely whether
it's a tool for you, right?
It's all, whether it's a building something. When I was, you know, my first programs were after I learned how to write BASIC. My first programs were because I was a dungeon master for D&D and I was tired of rolling all the dice for non-player characters. And so I was like, I'm going to write a program that just generates non-player characters, because they keep on dying so quickly. It's a pain in the neck.
See, and it's always been a problem for me, because I like learning new languages and learning code, and I don't ever have anything I need to do with them. So we need to get together, because I like to write the code and I like to learn new languages. I never have anything to do with it.
I can fix that for you.
Yeah, give me some things to do. Some tasks.
All right, that sounds good.
Yeah. Taylor Swift, Apple Beats One. We'll wrap it up with this, and then we'll get to your picks of the week.
What a turnaround.
Pardon me?
What a turnaround.
What a turnaround for Taylor and Beats One. Here she is.
And Eddie.
And Eddie Q. She's got her gym playlist. She's listening. Oh, on the treadmill. She's really blossomed into a beautiful young woman, I have to say.
And so business savvy.
She's so savvy.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, she seems as though she's in complete control of her
image. Yeah.
Her image, her business, her content. And also the her ability, the amount of poise and class that she's shown in the face of utter self-involved blowhards,
right,
trying to show her up.
Whoa! Taylor, are you okay? I think she even does her own stunts. For those of you listening, she does a face plant on the treadmill. I'm going to have to look at this really closely to see if there's a stunt double.
It's a stunt double. I'm almost certain.
Or I'm thinking they were making the commercial and it happened. Well, that's pretty good.
So
that's a good classic judo fall, though. I mean, that's a total.
Oh, she knows
right
what
there.
She knows how to fall. Maybe
I don't know if she does, but I mean, that's she's slapping the ground. Yeah.
Oh yeah, the slap is the wrestler slap,
well,
right?
The cutting the frame with the way it's framed, cutting the frame with the right there. You know, it's there's actually you don't see the what's down below her.
Yeah.
And but you do cut the frame with the treadmill, and so
shut up. You're just ruining all my dreams, Alex Lindsay. I hate you.
Maybe Taylor has mad skills.
I just don't think that anyone would let Taylor do that.
Is that Taylor? Is that Taylor right now? On this still?
I'm gonna guess that the bottom part is somebody else, and the top part is her.
And they cut back to her.
That looks like her belly.
But just keep, if you keep going, you'll
right there. It's not Taylor.
It doesn't look like Taylor.
Yeah, the hair's different.
Yeah,
come on. You guys are so cynical.
Yeah.
That's always the problem whenever they put
Taylor
in stunt
does
doubles.
Her own stunts.
If they it was end-to-end encrypted, wigs. We could verify that it was Taylor.
So you don't see her face here. Notice how when you come off this, she's turned away. That's a classic.
Now it's...
So you take...
Where did you cut there?
Frame. Okay, you take the last frame of...
I hate you, Alex Lindsay.
Sorry, you take the last frame of the of where she landed. You have Taylor match that, and then
you have her match it.
You know, and then
it's her face,
and then she moves up. But because you don't see her face during the fall, if she had turned her face towards you, it would have been. I wouldn't have said it was her, but I would have said it a lot harder.
Right? Because that's like a stunt double, obvious when there you don't see the face.
They make absolutely sure that you don't see her face during the entire fall until she stopped, where they can make the transition.
I'm choosing to believe it's Taylor.
I think it happened in the shooting, and they thought. Oh, of course, if it had happened in the shooting, hundreds of assistants would have poured from the sides, saying, "Mr. Swift, are you okay? You're our paycheck. Please, I hope you're okay."
They just said, "Imagine the treadmill is Kanye and hit it."
Leo, one trick with YouTube is if you click on the timeline,
can I
click on
I...
the timeline dot, hold and pull up,
and then pull up.
Yeah, it should give you. It should give you the ability. Maybe it's only in Chrome, but it gives you the ability to frame shutter.
Nice. I would like to. QuickTime used to do that, which was really handy. Which was you
if
could,
it's any,
you could step
if it's any consolation, I think the high speed video of Adam Savage falling on the treadmill while doing a drinking myth bust.
That's real.
I'm sure that's
real. That's
real. I'm sure he did that stunt.
That's real.
But it's still Apple went from her complaining very publicly about them to her starring in their commercial pretty quick.
She's a friend of Apple.
Uh-huh. Some companies would have doubled down on the stupid there and just made it like a bad situation for a long period of time. So this, I think, is good PR on their point.
And then in that commercial, they punch her face to the ground. So
maybe there was a little vicarious joy.
They didn't tell her about the ending of the scripted
Tim
ending.
Tim Cook said, "Can you make her fall on her face at the end?" All right, Eddie Q might have. All right, we're going to take a break. Come back with your picks of the week. So everybody, get ready. But first, I got to talk about my pick of the sleep, Casper. Man, I love my mattress. I was lying on my Casper pillow last night with my Casper mattress, feeling good. A great
I did that last night, Leo. I just fell backwards, and I left my feet on the floor. I fell backwards, and I just sank into it, and you just felt all the stress melt away.
It's nice because it's hard to describe, but it really feels great. It's a cool mattress. We got an 86, some say 90 degree day tomorrow, but I don't have to worry about that because my Casper mattress breathes. It feels cool. It's a great mattress, obsessively engineered at a fair price. And you can buy it online. And the nice thing is you don't have to try before you buy because they give you 100 days, or maybe I should say 100 nights, free delivery. And if at any time in the first 100 nights you decide, I want to go back to my old mattress, they'll come, they'll get it, they'll take it away and return every penny. So forget lying on a mattress in a showroom. That's no way to test a mattress. Get it in your home. Really, really get down on that mattress. Made in the USA. The pillows, can I say, are awesome. Their dual-layer responsive pillow is a perfect adjunct for your Casper. You can get them both right now at Casper, CASPER.com. But please go to Casper.com/MacBreak. That'll let them know you heard it on our show. And as a thank you, if you use the offer code MacBreak, we'll give you $50 off any size. Casper.com/MacBreak. The offer code is MacBreak, worth $50 off. Some terms and conditions apply. For details, visit Casper.com/terms. A perfect, perfect mattress for a fraction of the price. That's Casper. Casper.com/MacBreak. Andy Iannocco, your pick of the week. Okay, Leo Laporte, your pick of the week. I'll stall for Andy.
No,
I'll finish. No, it's good. I've installed WhatsApp. I am still miffed a little bit. They don't have an iPad app. Got to work on that. But they do have a web app, and that at least that's important for me. It's web.whatsapp.com, and I won't show the QR code right now because that would be giving away my – but what you do is you take your WhatsApp and you shine the QR code in from the computer in the WhatsApp, and then it says, oh, good, I got your account on your phone in the computer, and then you can stay signed in and use WhatsApp on your desktop, which is, to me, at least a big part of what I look for in a messaging app, although I'm still wanting the iPad version. And the next thing, Facebook already did this with Facebook Messenger on Android. They'll never do it on iPhone for obvious reasons, but on Android, I can use Facebook Messenger as my SMS app, kind of like Apple's messages. I'd love to see that with WhatsApp as well.
A couple people, Leo, Snowden and Zdarsky, are pointing out that it doesn't protect who you're texting. So you still got to keep that in mind.
Metadata is still there.
Yeah.
Well, they probably can't protect that.
Yes.
I'm thinking. actually, they could. There are apps that are completely anonymous, you know, kind of Bitcoin-like apps where you don't communicate with people with their real names. The thing about WhatsApp is it matches you up with your phone number.
Yes.
So you're not anonymous in WhatsApp, and nor are the people you're talking to.
Yes.
But for users, that's a convenience. Otherwise, I'd have to kind of say to you, what's your secret number? And we'd have to arrange that somehow.
Yeah.
And then finally, it's voting day in Wisconsin. And I don't know about you, but I'm ready for this app. It's a Chrome filter, a Chrome extension called Trump Filter that lets you just delete Donald Trump from the web. You don't see it anymore.
Or move to Canada. We have room.
Do you not have stories every day in your news feeds about Donald Trump, even in Canada?
No, we have people like drunkenly riding moose and dropping maple syrup on sidewalks. We're really busy, Leo.
And by the way, I didn't give you condolences about the late mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford, who passed away at a very young age.
Yeah.
Shows that crack cocaine and politics are not good for your health.
No. But we did get transit directions. No relation. We did get transit directions in Montreal today on Apple Maps.
Oh,
so we do have cause to
that
celebrate.
That is nice. I like that.
Yes.
Now I've stalled enough for you, Andy. Andy was, you didn't see him, but he was like, he is off somewhere getting his stuff.
No. I was just the clamshell on the ears, and it gets my ears kind of sweaty.
Oh, you're letting your ears air out? Okay.
I was just,
you know, fair enough.
That's fine. really great pick this week. I've been looking forward to recommending this for quite a while. Ulysses, the really great word processor / text editor that's multi-platform. It works on Macs and iOS. A lot of big announcements. They created a brand new version 2.5 for iOS that supports every cool thing iOS 9 supports and every cool thing you want on an iPad Pro, whether the big one or the little one. So it supports slide over, it supports multitasking, split screen, all that cool stuff. It's a really great word processor to use alongside anything else you're using. The strong thing that has always existed with Ulysses has been it's in a category of word processor where it helps you to do things that might be defined as projects, where it's not one file that you're working on as powerful as Microsoft Word is. It's something where you're thinking more about, I have folders of related documents that I'm working on, whether it's a research project, a novel, a nonfiction book, a thesis. It's the sort of thing where you really need to keep notes and different chapters and everything really nicely organized and together. And it really makes it really, really easy to organize stuff that's in progress or in process. So this really is probably, for now, the only iOS word processor where you really could write an entire novel on this and be very, very comfortable in that space. In addition to all this other cool split screen sort of stuff for iOS, it also supports has a new sharing sheet, so that if you're, let's say you're doing research on a book and you're in a browser, you could simply send a URL or send some text or send whatever out of that app and send it into Ulysses. And so it'll just be waiting for you there in your inbox. The only disadvantage of it is that it's flat text only, as is, the way that you're editing. So you don't get the sort of rich text experience that you would have on in Microsoft Word or in Pages. But it does support Markdown, so you can do very sophisticated formatting by using the right tokens and the right the right margins and that sort of thing. It also will support import export of DocX files, so you can move files into and out of it from Microsoft Office. It supports cloud services, it supports cloud sync, so it's easy to move files across them. This new version also supports the iPhone, so you really can be a triple threat and use whatever device you have to manipulate all your data and edit, write, update whatever the project's going to be. There is another good piece of news on the complicated writing front that Literature and Latte have been posting intermittent blog posts talking about what progress they're making on Scrivener for iOS. My favorite word processor by far. It takes something like Ulysses and takes it up another 7 levels in complex, in the ability to manage major projects and sort of develop thoughts into actual printed text. The latest blog post says that, okay, all the people that we had hired earlier on to work on this punted, and now I decided I'm going to learn how to write an iOS app myself.
Wow.
And now finally, we don't have a date or anything like that, but we're really, really close to announcing a beta. And so hopefully we will see that by the end of the year. Even when that gets released, Ulysses will always have this unique spot. It's a less heavy duty and therefore less intimidating version of Scrivener. But the ability to have this one app that can manage a complex project across 3 different platforms and make it really easy to get text in and out of it when you need to put it someplace else, really, really big deal. The iOS app is $24.99 for a limited time. It's down to $19.99, but it's a real, for me, it's a real easy amount of money to spend. It really has become my default writing tool on iOS, and it's absolutely perfectly integrated with the way that you want to work on an iPad Pro.
I have to say, with the integration into Medium, that makes it even more intriguing, because Medium has just added the ability. I mean, they're really trying to get publications to use it as their content management system. They've got all sorts of new features, and a number of web publications. Jean-Louis Gasset's Monday Note is now on Medium. You can monetize, and so you could write your Medium articles on Ulysses and then automatically post them up there. So that's very interesting.
Yeah. There's just a lot to love here. There is also a full embracement of keyboard navigation. You can change layouts, and there are a lot of people that have been really embracing Ulysses to do a lot of different things. So that there are a lot of people who have been trying to export into web formats, trying to export into other things. You can't necessarily publish directly from it, but it's starting to become like Medium, kind of a Medium in and of itself. Enough people are using it as a platform that there are solutions to pretty much everything you want to get for it.
Ulysses, and it's a little weird finding it on the iPad. Best thing to do, go to Ulysses app on your browser and you get a link. Yep. It's Ulysses Mobile from the Soul Men. What do you want for nothing, rubber biscuit?
Actually, the update, if you bought a previous version of Ulysses, the update is completely free. So they didn't try to charge you brand new for it.
Nice.
Well, but definitely worth every penny of that $25. And you don't have to pay every penny of that, just the first 19
months. Actually, I think they went back to $25. I have bad news for you. I just paid $25. That's all right.
Oh, well.
Totally worth it.
They deserve the extra $5.
Yeah. I have a lot of writing apps now on my iPad. And I'm not sure what I'm going to end up using full time. I've been playing with Editorial, which I like a lot.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Apple sort of forced the evolution of these really good simplified writing apps with fewer distractions, minimal user interface, just by making it so damn difficult for any developer to create what is recognizably a WYSIWYG word processor
on
iOS. So
right.
maybe that was their plan all along. That was just brilliant strategy on their part.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Rene Ritchie and his pick of the week.
So I have two quick picks. One is Bitmoji, which I know Megan is already familiar with. But I saw someone
I'm avoiding this one.
Oh, Leo, you got to make a Leo Bitmoji.
No,
so,
I did, actually. I tweeted it. I'm embarrassed to say.
So Georgia and I now have entire conversations that I'm going to show you a big phone so you can see it that are just totally Bitmoji-based. And when I want to reply, because it's a custom keyboard, I just tap on it and it gives me... So basically you download it and it's a keyboard you install on your iPhone and then you design your Bitmoji and it takes what you design and applies that to its template of, I don't know, 50 or 100 different pre-generated cartoons. And then you just use those. Because there's limitations in iOS, you can't inject an image straight from a keyboard. So you copy it, paste it in, and then you just send it like you would an image. But it's one of those things where like a picture tells 1,000 words, but an emoji can sort of convey 1,000 emotions. And whether you're being sarcastic or sincere, it's sort of liberating to be able to talk in pictographs and pictures. But it's super personal because it's made to mean and represent you. And they're really timely. Like they had Star Wars ones for a while, they had Easter ones, and they refresh all the different built-in ones, you know, fairly frequently. So there's always something new to test out. And the new version, it used to be bit strips, which I never found attractive, but Bitmoji are super cute. They've just been bought by Snapchat, so depends on how you feel about that. But the app is still in the store and it's still working. And if you want to sort of take your picture messaging game to the next level, it's just a lot of fun, and it takes a lot of the seriousness out of what can be really drab text communications. So I've been using it a lot. My mom ended up making one. My sister and my boss made one. A bunch of my friends made them, and they just throw them in every once in a while, and it really breaks up the monotony of the text.
I'm a big sticker fan, so I guess I should probably start using it too. So the way you have to use this alternate keyboard, though, right?
Yeah, there's one for iOS, there's one for Android, so you can do cross-platform Bitmoji to your heart's content. And then you can also, if you want to put them in something like Instagram, you just save them out and, you know, upload them into Instagram. And then you can do like seriously or come on or whatever.
Or does this emoji make my butt look fat? Well,
they have all sorts of really fun ones. they have all sorts of really, and again, topical ones too. Like there's Batman and Superman ones right now, and there were X-Files ones and Matrix ones. And it's super interesting.
So the other quick pick, sorry. Typed a colon in an open parentheses, and that was good enough for us.
That was ASCII art, the days of ASCII art.
Didn't even need high ASCII, it's just good old-fashioned.
It's an ASCII for your ass. No, that's wrong.
The other thing I wanted to mention quickly was Text Expander just came out with a full new software suite, and it's been a little controversial because they're switching to a subscription model.
Yeah, that's weird.
And so, well, I mean, we're in the day where software has no value and these companies want to keep making it. And we have a choice of whether we, like in the old days, software was super expensive. So you couldn't buy many apps. I remember it was $40 to get a yellow sticky note app on my Trio. And I remember what Mac apps used to cost. So I just couldn't buy that many. So I was forced to choose the ones that really mattered to me. So for things like Text Expander, which I use every day, for me, it's not a big deal. It's like, I would love to pay for 1Password. I won't be able to afford every app, but I'll have to make choices. You know, I'm not owed any of these apps, but an app that I want to be able to invest in so that they keep making it and I don't have to suddenly do without it. So you can pay a monthly subscription fee or a yearly fee that's at a slightly reduced rate. I think a lot of people found it surprising because they didn't, as far as I know, they didn't pre-announce it, which might have taken some of the sting out. But you can still keep using the old version. And there's new versions of the Mac app and the iOS app. And I think a Windows beta. I don't think it's more along than a beta, but a Windows beta version of it. And one of the big new features is because they're doing this new subscription service is they're no longer using Dropbox or iCloud. They're doing all their own sync. But that let them create a team system. So if you had we have a Mobile Nations one. If you had a Twit one, you could share snippets the way like 1Password teams work, where you can have your private collection, but we can also have a bunch of snippets that just do mundane things that every one of us has to do every day. And those always stay shared and always stay synced in a little separate sort of above the fold part of Text Expander. So it's still really great. I'm trying the subscription for a while. I'm going to see if I like it. I'm going to see if I get value from it, but I think I will. And I think I'll continue using it. And I'm happy that sort of developers, instead of everyone complains you can't make money in the App Store, and then we yell at people who try. So
right.
I'm kind of stuck in the middle of this, but I want to support the ones that really... time is the only thing I have less of than money. If they can save me time, it's invaluable to me.
I love Text Expander, but I have to think twice with the monthly.
Sure.
Yeah. Mr. Alex Lindsay has been using his pick of the week all through the show, and it's been everything I could do not to say anything.
Yeah, so I have both a tip and a pick.
Because my last tip went over so well. I can't remember what it was, but I got all these
love the
tweets
tips.
About it. One is that I didn't really realize as I set up an Apple TV in our office that you could, there's now, if you haven't seen it, there is an app conference room display for your Apple TV. So it really is designed. We had a meeting with a client who had a Mac, and it was so easy. All they had, I mean, they immediately saw it in their AirPlay. They just saw, 200 conference room, and they just boom, and then their screen is right up on our, there's just no figuring out how to plug stuff in or what it's going to do or how to sync it. Or as soon as they were on the Wi-Fi, they were able to just plug into the screen. And so if you haven't done conference room display and set that up on your Apple TV and you're using it in a business environment, it's pretty awesome. So anyway, it was just as seamless as you would expect it to be, and it never is. There's always some issue, and typically it was not the case, at least for me so far. My pick is that, yes, the thing I've been using all, which I think it's turned out pretty well. This is the Shure. This is the MV51. So this is it's got a couple different settings. So I have right now I have it set to vocal, but I can change it to guitar and all kinds of other things it'll kind of base itself on it. Now, it's got a little kickstand on the back. If you take off, unscrew the back of it, you actually get a mic stand mount. So that little rubber thing in the back, you can unscrew that, and it'll just mount. Right now, I have it mounted onto a mic stand. And it's just the same, so I just took that little piece off, and I just screwed it right on. So you can do that if you want to get it a little closer to your mouth. I think it sounds great. I've been testing it for a couple of weeks now. I bought that and their interface. One of the things I got it for is the fact that it does use, it'll hook, that comes with a Lightning, a Lightning to micro cable, so that you can plug it right into your iPad or iPhone and use it as an audio source. So it's a pretty... it's got, low latency if you need it on the back so that you can hear what you're doing there. And it's just, it's a really well-built little USB mic. And it's a little bit smaller than some of the other ones that I've tested. So it's something that I feel like I can, throw in my bag and make it work. And so anyway, I'm very happy with it. I've tested a lot of these mics, and I think this is probably the one that I'll be carrying around with my in my bag until I test, another four mics. I mean, I think I own most of these mics at some point. And a lot of them sound good, but size and quality and all those things have to be mixed together, and I think it's a good mic.
Yeah, I have that one, and then this is a whole line from Shure. This is the
they've really gone
the MV88 from the Motive line, and this is the one I use for. And I showed this yesterday on iOS Today with Jason Snell for like blogging on my iPad because this has a Lightning connector. Yours does too. I mean, this is like a family of these, and I've been very happy with these mics, but also with the software, which allows you to change the mic pattern and add limiting and compression and all of that. So I carry this one, in my backpack. I have this with me all the time.
And this one is the MVI, which is another part of this family. So this one is, you can plug it into Lightning.
So you can use any mic with that.
Yeah. So if you have another mic and you want to have it as an interface to your computer or to your iPhone or iPad, you can use this as the interface.
So that you can use with a Heil or whatever.
Exactly. So if you already got a mic that you want, but you want to connect it to your, we've gone through lots of these. there's been, for over the 10 years, there's been different versions. A little heavy, but the quality is really nice. And it's, it's really easy to set up. I actually use this with, I use it with our comm system. I actually have a clear comm system on my iPad and use this to get out to speakers and headsets and all kinds of stuff. So it works really well.
A great recommendation from Alex Lindsay. I want to, before we wrap, thank one of our viewers, Calvin T. Hughes Jr. Since we're doing Macintosh History Week or Apple History Week on its 40th anniversary, remember this? The very first Mac World. This, I think, came in the box when you bought a Macintosh. I know you got a subscription, but I think they might have also bundled the Mac World number one. And I couldn't pull it out and show Jason Snell. I didn't want him to cry. But there's Steve Jobs in a tie. Actually, not Steve. Stephen Jobs in a tie. And there's inside here, there's a map of the Apple campus and all sorts of fun stuff. So Thank you, Calvin. This is really fun. I, of course, as probably you guys did also, I had one of these. I subscribed right away when I got my first Mac in 1984. Oh, I should have had Bill Atkinson sign this.
Oh,
darn it. There's Andy Hertzfeld. Where's Bill on this? He's probably in the back. He's a very unassuming guy. What was I thinking? I could have gotten a great autograph. Well, he did sign our wall. Is that him in the way in the back there?
He did give you a beautiful photo.
Oh, and he, for Alex Gumpel, who is a collector of ancient Mac stuff, he did sign. Look at that.
A+.
Nice.
HyperCard box.
Choice. Oh, man.
HyperCard box signed by Bill Atkinson. I might steal this. Gumpel's on vacation. He'll never know. Wow, is there actually HyperCard in here? Oh, my God. He's... So Alex is our, like, Windows fanatic here, right? But for some reason, unaccountable reason, this is shrink-wrapped in the box.
Look at that.
For some unaccountable reason, Alex collects Macintosh memorabilia.
For the young users at home, that's a 3.5-inch floppy disk.
What was that thing? Oh, I thought it was a coaster.
It's a save icon.
Floppy at all.
It's a save icon.
It's a save
icon. Oh, why do they put save icons in the box, Daddy? I don't know, son.
I want those toys.
Look at that, Daddy. It's a save icon. Wow. I didn't realize that you got Bill to do this. Holy cow. That is something.
Great.
Hey, thank you, everybody, for being here. Do watch that interview. Part one on the Twit website, twit.tv/TRI. It's episode 244. Part two will emerge a couple of weeks from now because we have so many amazing people coming up on Triangulation. For instance, James Gosling, the inventor of Java, is next Monday. I couldn't bump him. Oh. So we'll get part two of the Bill Atkinson interview. Those of you who saw it live, no, it was
exceptionally phenomenal. Good episode.
Yeah, he was really great.
Yeah,
we do Mac Break every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. Please stop in and watch it live. Join us in the audience. We had a great studio audience. Thank you for being here. All you have to do is email tickets@twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. But you know what? We have extra chairs. So if you don't email, we'll find one for you. But you don't get the ham. Sorry. We have to buy those ahead of time. And you, of course, can on-demand into audio and video, minus the ham. No, I'm afraid Andy and I add the ham no matter what. At twit.tv/MBW or wherever you subscribe to your favorite shows, including all those podcast clients and the Twit apps on every platform. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time. Now, back to work, because guess what? Steve Gibson's here, and it's time for Security Now. Bye.